And welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, October 11th, 2021. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on a weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, it's plural, questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of the website of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week with our scripture reading. We're in the Gospel of Luke, and we're in chapter 5. Gospel of Luke, chapter 5, so we're going to read through chapter 5, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 5. And it came to pass that as the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, he stood by the lake of Gennesaret, and saw two ships standing by the lake, but the fishermen were gone out of them, and were washing their nets. And he entered into one of the ships, which was Simon's, and prayed him that he would thrust out a little from the land. And he sat down, and taught the people out of the ship. Now when he had left speaking, he said unto Simon, Launch out into the deep, and let down your nets for a draught. And Simon answering said unto him, Master, we have toiled all the night, and have taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy word I will let down the net. And when they had this done, they enclosed a great multitude of fishes, and their net brake. And they beckoned unto their partners, which were in the other ship, that they should come and help them. And they came and filled both the ships, so that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. For he was astonished, and all that were with him, at the draught of the fishes which they had taken. And so was also James and John, the sons of Zebedee, which were partners with Simon. And Jesus said unto Simon, Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men. And when they had brought their ships to land, they forsook all and followed him. And it came to pass, when he was in a certain city, behold, a man full of leprosy, who, seeing Jesus, fell on his face and besought him, saying, Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And he put forth his hand and touched him, saying, I will, be thou clean. And immediately the leprosy departed from him. And he charged him to tell no man, but go and show thyself to the priest, and offer for thy cleansing according as Moses commanded, for a testimony unto them. But so much the more went there a fame abroad of him, and great multitudes came together to hear, and to be healed by him of their infirmities. And he withdrew himself into the wilderness, and prayed. And it came to pass on a certain day, as he was teaching, that there were Pharisees and doctors of the law sitting by, which were come out of every town of Galilee, and Judea, and Jerusalem, and the power of the Lord was present to heal them. And behold, men brought in a bed a man which was taken with the palsy, and they sought means to bring him in and to lay him before him. And when they could not find by what way they might bring him in, because of the multitude, they went upon the housetop, and let him down through the tiling with his couch into the midst before Jesus. And when he saw their faith, he said unto him, Man, thy sins are forgiven thee. And the scribes and the Pharisees began to reason, saying, Who is this which speaketh blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God alone? But when Jesus perceived their thoughts, he answering said unto them, What reason ye in your hearts? Whether is easier, to say, Thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, Rise up and walk? But that ye may know that the Son of Man hath power upon earth to forgive sins, he said unto the sick of the palsy, I say unto thee, Arise, and take up thy couch, and go into thine house. And immediately he rose up before them, and took up that whereon he lay, and departed to his own house, glorifying God. And they were all amazed, and they glorified God, and were filled with fear, saying, We have seen strange things today. And after these things he went forth, and saw a publican named Levi sitting at the receipt of custom. And he said unto him, Follow me. And he left all, rose up, and followed him. And Levi made him a great feast in his own house. and there was a great company of publicans and of others that sat down with them. But their scribes and Pharisees murmured against his disciples, saying, Why do ye eat and drink with publicans and sinners? And Jesus answering said unto them, They that are whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. And they said unto him, Why do the disciples of John fast often and make prayers, and likewise the disciples of the Pharisees, but thine eat and drink? And he said unto them, Can ye make the children of the bride chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken away from them, and then shall they fast in those days. And he spake also a parable unto them. No man putteth a piece of a new garment upon an old. If otherwise, then both the new maketh a rent, and the piece that was taken out of the new agreeth not with the old. And no man putteth new wine into old bottles, else the new wine will burst the bottles and be spilled, and the bottles shall perish. But new wine must be put into new bottles, and both are preserved. No man also, having drunk old wine, straightway desireth new, for he saith, The old is better.
Okay, tonight we're going to take a look at abrogation of the common law. We written a memorandum quite some time ago, and we have filed it with the courts. And let me see if I can find it in here. It should be under action against the judiciary, I believe it is. We've got numerous memorandums here. The memorandum I'm going to read is pretty much this memorandum, but it might have been updated because the one I'm going to read is the one I've got in the book. We've got 30 memorandums in the book, Government by Consent, and all of these memorandums here that we filed with the courts are in the book, and then we have some extra, some additional memorandums. But there might be a little difference in reading it because I know before... when I took these memorandums, I might have gone through them, maybe updated them, maybe added something to them, maybe found a better way to say things, or maybe even some corrections, so that when we filed, so when we put it into the book, we had the updated version. So we're going to read from at least the updated version. And again, it may be identical. So if anybody would like to read it, you should find it in here under memorandums, which again is under grand jury action against the judiciary. And these are the papers that we have filed in the court system. Now, there are some other papers that we have filed in the sense of cases that we've moved for causes and other habeas corpuses that we haven't put in here, and some indictments that we've done with numerous judges that we've put in here also. But let us go and take a look here tonight at random. Again, it's the abrogation of the common law of the land. Memorandum of law. Before I get started, I just want to make some notes concerning equity. These are U.S. codes. This particular, what we're going to read a lot of tonight is under U.S.C. Title 18. And U.S.C. Title 18 is lawful law when it's applied appropriately, when it's applied against a bureaucrat, when it's applied against individuals involved in interstate commerce in the case of the federal level. Or if people are involved with unlawful, interstate commerce of one kind or another, then of course they are held under these laws also. But we the people are held under no law but the law of God, the law of the land, which ultimately is the common law or the natural law. And again, these codes are only applied upon the bureaucrat and individuals involved in specific commercial activity. So let's take a look at this. It's going to be a short read tonight. It's only about 8 or 9 minutes, so it's not going to be too long. And then we'll have some, if anybody has a question or a comment, matter of fact, let me go into the queue. So as we're reading through this, if anybody has a question or a comment or a correction on this paper, they're welcome to pick up the mic. Here's star 6, and I believe you'll be asked to click a 1 also. So star 6 and a 1, and you'll be able to get into the queue, and we'll take your questions, comments, or corrections. So,
Uh,
Abrogation of the Common Law, Memorandum of Law. We the people have found a preponderance of evidence that many members of the United States Supreme Court, the Federal Judiciary, the United States House of Representatives, and the United States Senate are systematically and covertly subverting the law of the land, violating the following subsections under United States Code Title 18, Section 115. Subsection 2381, Treason. Whoever owing allegiance to the United States levies war against them or adheres to their enemy, giving them aid and comfort within the United States or elsewhere, is guilty of treason and shall suffer death, or shall be imprisoned not less than 5 years and fined under this title but not less than $10,000, and shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. Subsection 2382, Misprision of Treason. Whoever, owing allegiance to the United States and having knowledge of the commission of any treason against them, conceals and does not, as soon as may be, disclose and make known the same to the President or to some judge of the United States or to the Governor or to some judge of justice of a particular state, is guilty of misprision of treason and shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 7 years or both. Subsection 2383, Rebellion or Insurrection. Whoever incites, sets on foot, assists, or engages in any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or the laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both, and shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. Subsection 2384, Seditious Conspiracy. If two or more persons in any state or territory or to any place subject to the jurisdiction of the United States conspire to overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against them, or to oppose by force the authority thereof, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States contrary to the authority thereof, they shall each be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. Subsection 2385, Advocating the Overthrow of Government. Whoever knowingly or willfully advocates, abets, advises, or teaches the duty, necessary, desirability, or propriety of overthrowing or destroying the government of the United States or the government of any state, territory, district, or possession thereof, or the government of any political subdivision therein, by force or violence, or by assassination of any officer of any such government, or whoever with intent to cause the overthrow or destruction of any such government prints, publishes, edits, issues, circulates, sells, distributes, or publicly displays any written or printed material or matter advocating, advising, or teaching the duty, necessary, desirability, or propriety of overthrowing or destroying any government in the United States by force or violence, or attempts to do so, or whoever organizes to help or attempts to organize any society, group, or assembly of persons who teach, advocate, or encourage the overthrow or destruction of any such government by force or violence, or becomes or is a member of or affiliates with any such society, group, or assembly of persons, knowing the purpose thereof, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both, and shall be ineligible for employment of the United States or any department or agencies thereof for the 5 years next following his conviction. If two or more persons conspire to commit any offense named in this section, each shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both, and shall be ineligible for employment by the United States or any department of agencies thereof for the 5 years next following his conviction. As used in this section, the terms organizes and organize with respect to any society, group, or assembly of persons include the recruiting of new members, the forming of new units, and the regrouping or expansion of existing clubs, classes, and other units of such society, group, or assembly of persons. They have levied war against the Constitution and thereby we the people. Cooper versus Aaron. Any judge who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution of the United States wars against that Constitution and engages in acts and violence of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. They have given aid and comfort to the enemy within the United States and elsewhere. They have concealed a conspiracy to destroy our republic. They have engaged in actions to subvert the government of the United States. They have conspired to conceal natural law, also known as the law of the land. They have, in congruence with the teaching of the American Bar Association, the National Lawyers Guild, the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Lawyers Association, and Southern Poverty Law Center, and many other anti-constitutional associations, knowingly and willfully advocate, abet, advise, and teach that natural law, and thereby the law of the land, has been abrogated, and thus have conspired to overthrow our republic. The courts have concealed our natural law courts under Federal Rule 2 in violation of 18 U.S.C. subsection 1001. According to the Federal Judiciary Center, a government agency, on September 16, 1938, pursuant to its fictional authority under the Repugnant Rules Enabling Act of 1934, stated, "The Supreme Court enacted uniform rules of procedure for the federal courts. Under the new rules, suits in equity and suits at common law will group together under the term civil action, claiming that rigid application of common law rules brought about injustice." See the website. This was an act of treason, whereas the U.S. Supreme Court and the U.S. Congress, under the teaching and guidance of the treacherous and subversive American Bar Association and the aforesaid Anti-Constitutional Association, in an act of treason, executed a silent coup by claiming the abrogation of common law, also known as natural law, with its unalienable Bill of Rights, and that were endowed by our Creator, and covertly substituted them with civil rights legislated by lawless men. Miranda versus Arizona. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Okay, I see we have a couple people in the queue for questions. Anybody else has a question or a comment concerning what we just looked at? Hit star 6 and a 1 and you'll get into the queue. So we're going to just take questions on this subject matter for now, then we're going to move on to other questions that people have sent in, and I don't know. Terry, is Brent here tonight? Has anyone seen him?
Okay. I have not seen him. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Anyway, we'll take some questions, and we'll see where we go from there. Heather Lee, I see you're in the queue. You got the mic. Go right ahead, Heather.
Yes, I have a question, John, with first of all, what page area is that on for the judges?
You're asking where is this memorandum?
Yeah, where is that memorandum?
It's under grand jury. You can find this. Hang on a minute. I'm highlighting it now. Are you coming in by computer screen or app?
No, I'm on the phone. I have the book in my hand, though.
Well, you can go into, of course, our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and highlight grand jury on the far right-hand side of the toolbar. Come down two steps. You'll hit action against the judiciary. And when you click on that, you can see the extraordinary action that we filed against the United States Supreme Court, the Federal District Judiciary, the U.S. House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate. And all the papers that we have filed is in here and dated. And then all the memorandums right underneath that that we had filed this year, and also those cases that we moved from CORS and the habeas corpuses.
Okay.
We also moved to also the New York SAFE Act case. We moved for CORS into this case also. So there's quite a few cases moved into this particular court.
Okay.
But it looks like we have maybe about, I don't know, about 20 memorandums that we filed into court here, and this was one of them.
All right. Very good. The second thing, I'll look into that. The second thing is, you know, I mentioned to you that there's a need for the last booklet, the pamphlet, on the Common Law Grand Jury Administrator.
Mm-hmm.
You're working on that?
Well, I haven't completed that. I've got a lot of notes, and I'm glad you reminded me. I think you mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. But it is something I need to work on probably very soon, because hopefully we'll be gaining access into the courts. I know there are some people who are building committees of safety in various counties across the nation and connecting with their sheriff. We're getting books out to the sheriff right now. I think we've got about 315.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah. It's just that we're trying to form these, you know, I'm trying to work with some people in Michigan here, and all the other booklets are there, but that's mm-hmm. missing. And that administrator is a really important one, because he selects the grand jury. So, and it is a paid position, and there is interest on that to be take the courses through National Liberty Alliance and such, but there's no booklet. So anyway.
Right. We're creating that handbook, and I'll focus in on that being my next endeavor.
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah,
okay.
And Dan said that he has some notes, and so does Eric Levy,
okay.
So just to let you know. Anyway.
Okay. We did. Let me just talk a little more about that and some of the things for other people to know and learn for what we're doing here. You know, we do have, of course, the orientation for the grand jury, and that's one of the things that the jury administrators will be doing, and for the trial jury, of course, they need to be oriented too. And we did write the book, which we just finished reading last week. It was a four-part read. It was quite long. I think it was 35 pages or something like that. It took 4 weeks to read through it on a Monday. And that is the orientation for the jury. I'm thinking on, I'm not too sure how I want to approach that. You know, maybe it's something that the jury, when they come together, should read sections, a section at a time. You know, people would take people would read different parts as they get through that particular handbook in the course of the day. And then discuss it, have a conversation concerning what they have read, because it's important to sink into the minds and hearts of the individuals that's going to be sitting on grand juries or trial juries, to really sink this in, to have the proper state of mind, to be, you know, properly orientated for the process that they're about to enter into, which is to decide on whether someone's going to be indicted in one case of the grand jury, and or whether someone is guilty or not of a crime in the case of a trial jury, in particularly in criminal cases. Now, the grand jury administrators, just as a refresher, we haven't spoke about this for a while, but for those who don't know, there are about 3,134 counties, and of those counties is 3,100 or so probably state courts. Well, there's a state court in every single county anyway. There may be, of course, there are some certain counties that are so, isolated. There's not many people living in them, like up in Alaska, certain parts of Maine and various other places. And they might have to go to another county to go into a court because it's, there's not that many people living in those counties. So whatever the number is. But here's the key thing. We need four people who have become administrators for the grand and trial jury, which means they would have the job to orientate them and prepare them and also deal with problems and give access to different places that the jury might request and want to investigate in. For instance, they might even discover things on their own when they're a sitting grand jury, and they may want to go into a particular office, some government office, to look into things and investigate and ask questions. And it would be the jury administrators, it would be those individuals' duty to order to prepare and and forge a way for them to go and have these, you know, interviews that they would want to have with these individuals and or looking into the records within any government office, because this is, you know, the people's duty and their right to investigate the government, to ask questions. They have a duty to answer. And when a bureaucrat refuses to answer, when they have a duty to answer a question, then that's fraud. And the United States Supreme Court has ruled on that, as a matter of fact, on numerous occasions, that when they have a duty to speak and they remain silent, it's fraud. You know, so when we look into Congress, for instance, when some of these people have been interviewed by Congress and asked questions, and in some cases they plead the fifth, the right of silence, and so on, well, they don't have the ability to make that plea if they are a bureaucrat, someone who has been elected in a position and took an oath to fulfill the duties within their positions. And they have a duty to answer. They cannot plead the fifth because, again, they're being asked a question concerning their duties and they must answer. That being the case, of course, they can be held in contempt and things. And, of course, then an investigation could open up if it's the grand jury asking the questions. I know Congress asks questions and I've seen in many a times where they turned and said, that they plead the fifth. But anyway, there are four individuals who are administrators, and they're to orient the jury, make sure that the grand jury is not tainted, make sure that they're protected from being tainted by a judge or prosecutor or any other individual. They're to work, and this is a paid position, and we also need a legal secretary will also work from time to time as an administrator also, maybe when one is on vacation or whatever. Every county must have at least four administrators, and I think that probably is sufficient for most counties. There are certain counties where there's a high population. For instance, you take New York City, there is made up of five counties, and each one of those counties have a high population, close to 1 million. And so, therefore, there may be a need for more than four. But four is the standard and the bare minimum. And this comes from the Magna Carta. That's how we came up with this idea of four people.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
With the administrator, if a county doesn't have an administrator, can't that an administrator from another county serve that county?
Well, the key thing here is to get people to deal in their county. If there are no administrators within a particular county, then the people haven't stepped up to create a committee of safety and started to fill these positions, which again is a full-time job, paid position. It's a career job, and they have the commissioners of jurors in Dutchess County where I live. There's a commission of jurors right next to the courthouse. But those are bureaucrats hired by the government itself, and they do the will of the government. This has to go to the people. The people have to be separate from the government, and there is a process in a way we can set up all the necessary funding and things working through the county to fund the payroll and the necessary things that would be needed by the jury administrators. And actually, they should be able to take over the building or the offices that the jury commissioners of jurors would have had. But again, they cannot be directly hired directly by the government under any government control, working and operating under any kind of equity. They fully are completely 100% have to be under the law. And the law, of course, is the natural law under the rules of the common law. Also, just to make a note here, even laws of equity, which is what's called positive law, and again, I think they chose that name to make it look like law, but it's not law in the sense that it applies to we the people. It is law, though, to the sense of statutes that apply to bureaucrats, as we mentioned. But equity cannot control jurors, nor can it control the administration. The administrators of the jurors. So, again, we're looking for five individuals to step up and take the power and the authority of that position, again, a paid position, a career position. Another note to make on this is the people who step up to take up this position do not have to live in that county. Now, they can live in the county next door. So if the positions are filled in one county and someone desires that kind of a position, they can go to the county next door and fill the position there. And of course, at some point in time, maybe even change over to another county if that's what they want. But there are some cases where people in one county may be living a lot closer to the county, the courthouse in another county next door to them, and for convenience sake, they might want to do that. So I just do want to make that point. It is not necessary that the people live within the county in order to take those positions. So
now,
we have about, we need five people, like I said, four administrators and one paralegal secretary, who will also double as an administrator whenever it's necessary. And so you're taking 3,000 plus counties, let's say 3,000 counties. So we're looking at about 15,000 people to fulfill all of the necessary positions across the nation. And the best way for these people to be educated and prepared for is to participate with the creation of a committee of safety, be involved with the community, what's going on. And all this needs to tie in together, because when people have a problem against a bureaucrat, the first place they'll probably be led to, hopefully, would be the committee of safety within that county, who then can help that individual. Maybe it'll be something they would turn over and discuss with the administrators of the jury, or maybe it's something they'd be discussed with the people who are going to run. I don't want to say run for committeeman anymore, because I don't think we should. I'm going to have to write a paper on that and really lay out the purpose and the reasoning behind why we should not run for committeeman, but just take up the power and the authority of the committeeman. And for those who don't know, the committeemen are the people who put anybody who wants to run for office, the committeemen are the ones that put them onto the ballot. And this is a job of the people. But we'll discuss that in more detail at another time, and I'm going to have to write some papers on that to kind of bring that position up and lay out why it should be that way. But anyway, all the corrections and problems. Yeah.
But can I just ask you here?
Sure.
I just want to get this clear. They're county paid, then.
Correct.
You
get a county paycheck, and we'll have to set it up in such a way as a trust. Each county will have to create a trust, and that trust would have to answer to the comptroller. There would be a budget. We'd probably just start off using the budget, the last budget that is used by the commissioners of jurors, and use that budget and adjust it accordingly on a quarterly basis or whenever we feel necessary. And I'm sure we'll be able to operate a lot cheaper, because they're wasteful and do all kinds of silly things that we wouldn't do. Of course, there needs to be that funding. So that would go through the county comptroller, and there'd be people would have to, whoever would, for instance, the paralegal particularly, would be the responsible one to give an accounting on maybe a quarterly basis or whatever, however often is required by that county, just like any other government agency. But we wouldn't be a government agency. We would be a common law trust for the people, funded by the government, just like the government would fund also the education of children, particularly focusing in, of course, in schools on civics, on the Constitution, natural law, and who we are as a people.
Would it be
sure.
under the county treasurer?
No, it would be the comptroller. Well, it would come out of the county treasury. Yeah, that's where the money would come from, the county, of course.
Okay.
Remember, every county there is a state court, okay? And in every state court there should be a jury, a commissioners of jurors, and we'll call them, jury administrators, but they'll also could be called the same thing. And they would be responsible for calling the jury together, making sure that it's a fair cross of the county or the particular area where the trial is being held, and there's various resources that they can tie into to put that call out, and working again with the committee of safety should be working connecting all these things together and working on encouraging an education throughout the whole county to bring civics and common law and constitutional studies into the local schools from the grammar level all the way up, and at the same time going out into the community encouraging people to participate with the Committee of Safety, encouraging people, setting up courses, free courses, and we can probably do that through National Liberty Alliance, as we've got here already. We've got a civics course, we have a constitutional course, we have a government by consent course, we have a militia course, we've got quite a few courses, and they're all free with the exception of the government by consent course, where we request that people give us a donation of $5 a month or more to participate in that particular course. And of course that's how NLA is funded, in order to pay the bills, keep the lights on and so on. So, but I will work on that book and get that out as soon as possible. And I'm going to really endeavor hard. I'm working on a couple of court cases right now, and probably have about a week's worth of writing on that. But once that's done, I'll focus in on that book. But I do have lots of information, so it might not take me too long to put that booklet together.
Okay, I appreciate it, because the state of Michigan needs it.
Yeah, appreciate that. Yeah, and Michigan is on fire, I think. Michigan is moving. We have Sheriff Dahl working out there, organizing, and hopefully, you know, a lot of sheriffs are participating even more than what has been, because we've got the books that are going out for the Campaign for Constitutional Sheriffs. We do need to move them on a lot, on a faster pace, but right now, you know, we've got a little over 300 books out there. So anybody that hasn't yet participated in that campaign, we'd appreciate if they did. It's our duty to make sure that our sheriffs are fully informed, and that we ourselves are fully informed. For if the people expect to be ignorant and free, as Jefferson said, they expect what never was and never will be. So, you know, we're never going to have liberty the way we have, way we would desire it. We're never going to have just courts. We're never going to have government by consent unless the people learn how to do these things. And it's our duty. It's our job. And we need to teach our children that it's their duty, that they must do this also and participate, you know, on making sure our government is only doing what we consent to them to do. Hey, anything else?
I'm going to give somebody, I have other questions, John, but I give somebody else a chance.
Okay, yeah, and other questions outside of this we'll pick up in a little while. We've got two other people in the queue. Anybody else wants to get in the queue? Star 6 and 1, but again, let's stay focused on this subject matter here. We have someone from Denver, Colorado. You got the mic, go right ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, how you doing? What's your first name?
Hi, my name is Nicole. How are you doing tonight?
How you doing, Nicole? You sound familiar. I think we've spoken before.
Perhaps, or maybe I've just thought about this so much it's just come to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for all that you do. I actually listened to pretty much all of your video series today alone, and I'm going to do my best to get that more... more views and more shares and subscriptions, because it is invaluable. It is absolutely the most important thing that people should be thinking about and researching this time. The reason that I'm calling is because I feel that I've been gifted, if you will, a very unique view into what is really going on behind the scenes. I'm literally in the middle of one of the most difficult fights of my life. I'm not going to go into all the gory details, because that would take a few decades or so. But the point is that I've been able to have enough inner confidence to take a step back and actually, it's not what they are doing or what they're saying, it's what they're not doing and what they're not saying, and has been the loudest to me. And when you talk about constitutional sheriffs, the sheriff in this particular instance with what is going on with me is probably one of the most significant violators, which I have all of the instances documented and whatnot. And this is actually going, you know, to him in person and saying these things are happening, and it would lead me to believe that you are okay with this, and you know, these supposed deputies are under your, you know, care, custody, and control. And, you know, just fell on deaf ears. I went to the Board of County Commissioners. I said the same things. And things actually got worse for me. I've been dragged out of my home on Sunday nights at almost 11 o'clock, not afforded shoes, not given any, really dark, dark stuff. But yet I'm still here. And what I wanted to bring up tonight to you is the Clearfield Doctrine. 2 points. The Clearfield Doctrine. Are you familiar with that? I'm sure you are.
What doctrine?
The Clearfield Doctrine. And if I can give you just a
few brief... Yeah, I might be familiar, but I'm not sure. But go ahead.
Okay. And, pardon me. Whereas defined pursuant to Supreme Court annotated statute Clearfield Trust Company versus United States 318 U.S., 363-371, 1942. Governments descend to the level of a mere private corporation and take on the characteristics of a mere private citizen, where private corporate commercial paper, a.k.a. Federal Reserve notes, and securities, a.k.a. checks, is concerned. For purposes of suit, each corporation and individuals are regarded as entities entirely separate from government. And to expound on that, when private commercial paper is used by corporate government, the government loses its sovereignty status and becomes no different than a mere private corporation. Government then becomes bound to the rules and laws that govern private corporation, which means that if they intend to compel an individual to some specific performance based upon its corporate statutes or corporation rules, then the government, like any private corporation, must be the holder in due course of a contract or other commercial agreement between it and the one upon who demands for specific performance are made. And further, the government must be willing to enter the contract or commercial agreement into evidence before trying to get the court to enforce its demands.
Now, you're reading this particular doctrine, are you not?
I am, yes, from the Supreme Court, what's it called? When they give their...
The Supreme
their
Court decision? The U.S. decision?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you know, so, well, oh, but go ahead, finish off.
Oh, no problem. I just was wondering if you were familiar with it, and if so, is there some sort of loophole? Is there some sort of...
No, this is an actual case called Trust versus U.S. Is that what it is?
If you just, you can just Google Clearfield.
Well, a lot of this sounds familiar, so I might very well have read this particular paper before. I definitely am very familiar with the contents and from other sources, and I'm very familiar with the things you're talking about.
And it just came back around to my frontal vision, and I was like, wait a minute. Because obviously we know that it's a de facto government. We know that it's a non-constitutionally ran, you know, it's administrative tribunals, not even in the interest of justice. It's just in the interest of administrating its policy, its, you know, corporate policy. And it's trying to, you know, entrench us as if we are part of their corporation. And, pardon me, and so this, to me, and I've looked at it from this way and that way and, you know, every angle of light that I possibly can, because they are, you know, so to speak, our angels, so that tomorrow I have the most beautifully and eloquently prepared, because it's a pre-trial readiness conference tomorrow. And how I'm posing it is it's a pre-trial readiness for their trial is what I'm going to be proposing tomorrow.
Okay, so you're in court right now?
Yes, sir.
And you opened up a court of record? Are you familiar with the court of record?
Yes, I am Yep, and they have, and again, keep in mind, I have every single thing documented as to the illegality of their actions and bad behavior.
Well, bear in mind, they're going to work overtime to silence you as you go forward. You know, you've been in the courts before, making some arguments with these people already, or this is going to be your first hearing, or where are you?
Oh, no, this is, yep. When you said that, yeah, they've made, like I said, they've pulled me out of my home, away from my three children.
Yep.
At Sunday nights at almost 11 o'clock. They actually put me in the hospital, dislocated his shoulder and broke two teeth. It's been...
Yeah, they're the mob. They're intimidating you.
Yeah, they really, I mean, they talk about the RICO, you know, organized crime and, you know, enterprise, and it's like, do you guys actually read what you guys write down? Because you fit this pretty well.
Well, Judgment Day is coming for these people. I do believe that, and I don't think we're far from it. But they are evil. I mean, and I don't even know if they realize how evil they are, but they're so protective of their own, you know, power and authority and whatever else they're getting out of this, and a lot of them are lining their pockets up. A couple of things when you're reading and their perception and their perspective, you know, it's like a criminal making excuses on why they're a criminal and why it's okay, and that's exactly what they've done. They try to call themselves sovereign. I heard when you read in there concerning the word that they were sovereign. The government is not sovereign per se. The individuals that are in the government are not sovereign either. They're vested with certain powers and authorities. And so when they're outside of their work and as one of the people, and yeah, then they are sovereign as any other individual is sovereign. But when they're working in the office and they're vested with certain powers, that doesn't give them any more you know, ability to say, well, I'm sovereign and you can't take this away, or I can do what I want.
And right. If God made man and man made government, then government cannot usurp man. The created cannot control the creator.
Marbury versus Madison, right off the beginning, one of the first big cases out there going way back in the beginning of our nation, spoke about these things, that anything that is repugnant to the Constitution, or the law of the land, which is the Constitution, is null and void.
With your business as if it was never enacted. But
what was never enacted?
What's that?
You said what was never enacted.
Well, that a people of the, you know, nation or state can just continue on as if the null and void statute had never been enacted.
Right. Oh, yeah, as if it's never been enacted. That's correct. Everything they're doing, they think that they now have power and authority to continue on and go further. They continue to empower themselves and to empower, you know, others. For instance, the United States Congress, both houses back in 1934, they empowered the United States Supreme Court to write their own rules of the court. Now, there already were the rules of the court. We're a common law nation. We're under the rules of common law. Nothing has changed. But first of all, Congress didn't have the power or the authority to make rules of the court. And so therefore they, and clearly, even if they did have that power, they don't have the power to pass the other power and give more power to another government agency, which again would be the United States Supreme Court, which are actual equity courts. And the United States Supreme Court, of course, they themselves passed the power onto the Bar Association to write the necessary rules of the court. And the rules of the court are written in order to build the structure and the foundation for civil law. And as we read in tonight's paper, I'd like to really go back real quick and take at this. At the end of the paper, we read, and this is extremely important. And I'm going to, this is up on their website, on the Supreme Court's website, which is the Federal Judicial, FJC, Federal Judicial, goodness, I forget what the C is standing for. But it's .gov. So this is the federal court's website. The United States Supreme Court is part of this process, and they're the leadership of that court, and very much involved in this. And this is what they said. This is on their website, word for word. Then anybody that's looking on their browser, you can see the paper. I'm going to read right from it. The Supreme Court enacted uniform rules of procedure for the federal courts. Now, they don't have no power or authority to do that. Congress gave them authority and power, but they were not vested with that power to give power to anyone. Only the people can give power. Under the new rules, suits in equity and suits in common law will group together under the term civil action. Therein is your civil law. So they've taken our common law, they've even taken our equity, they brought it together, now they apply the statutes against the people, they call it civil action, it becomes civil law, and they claim the reasoning for that, as they go on claiming that, rigid application of common law rules brought about injustice. Well, how could God's rules, God's laws, bring about injustice? Of course, that's ridiculous. But nevertheless, they don't like these rigid applications because it's applied against them. And of course, they want to protect their own positions. They want to protect their own criminal activities. They want to hide them and do whatever it is that they've got to do or want to do. So this is an act of treason. It is an assault upon the Constitution and violence upon the people. And
if I may add to what you just said about them grouping common law or natural law with
together.
Civil
law. Well, it's called equity. Equity is the codes that they've written that we've given power and authority to write. There's about 57 codes, and they have power and the authority to write those codes, okay? And but they apply towards certain agencies. They have turned around and used 18 USC 18 and USC 28 as the penal code to come up against the people. And they apply and they apply now the equity against the people in courts of law, which now is now a civil law court. They totally destroyed our judicial system.
Right.
Totally.
Well, and what I wanted to add there is I was just going through the U.S. code, all of it today. And I found, and I'm trying to find it right now, but I found where they actually have it, like, listed in their whole, like, the short title or whatever about dropping certain phraseologies because the combination of equity, common law, and admiralty was now complete.
Yeah, well, again, you know, and we know that admiralty has nothing to do with the people either. So, look, at these people are criminals. They're organized crime. They move things into, you know, you talked about corporations. They moved into corporatism. Corporatism and Nazism are synonymous. And and that's where we're heading. And you can see clearly now they're being exposed because you see now that, for instance, the president and is putting all these requirements out and telling these corporations to do certain things, and they're obeying because they're all part of part and parcel the same. It's all one.
Well, yes,
and that's where we've ended up.
Wasn't it Erie Railroad versus Tompkins that pretty much changed the policy? Well, from public law to public policy, wasn't that the...
Well, I'm not too sure whether... I recall the case particularly. I'm not sure, you know, exactly what the details were of that case, but I do remember that case, and it had some powerful or some things in it. But was that the one where it tried to give power and authority to abrogate the common law?
So what happened was that a gentleman was walking along the railroad, and a board sticking out from one of the railroad cars struck him in the back of the head and caused significant serious bodily injury and harm.
Mm-hmm.
And since he is, that is part of natural law to be able to receive remedy or redress from, you know, whomever caused the harm.
Of course.
The Supreme Court at that time, because I believe it was obviously it's a 1938 case, but the Supreme Court decided in favor of the corporation, Erie Railroad,
which
is the singular, divinely created, spiritual being having a physical experience. He was not as important as the protection.
And it's very interesting that this came about in 1938 because that's when the Rules Enabling Act came in force. As a matter of fact, there were eight judges went along with that. One judge resigned and didn't vote at all on it, and the other eight judges voted it in or put their name to it for the rules of the court now.
Yeah.
And
right.
A lot of things took place in 1938. There was a big Nazi movement down here in New York City. And various things going on. And this particular case, as you said, you know, take the case, you know, when they come out and they say, well, okay, look, let's take the pharmaceutical companies. And they give them a free will and say, well, look, if you get injured by this, you can't do anything. That doesn't amount to a hill of beans in the court of law. And that's what the people need to understand. We can negate anything that they have to say. And so it's, jury nullification. So just nullify it. And that's where the people have to get the knowledge to understand that. And that's why orientation, the proper orientation of a jury is so important, whether it be a grand jury or a petit jury. They need to be properly orientated. They need to come to a certain mindset and an understanding. And that's why we wrote that paper, which is the Jurist Handbook. Now, that Jurist Handbook, you know, I was encouraged to write that over. I went and looked at the federal handbook, the jury handbook, and I've also seen some state. I think New York State has one too, but there was I think it was New York State that I had read also, but it was the federal that I was focusing in on particularly, and they're all assaultive upon the law. They destroy the law, and they take all the power away from the people, and they give it to the judge and to the prosecutor, especially the U.S. attorneys. And so when people go into court, I mean, they're up against everybody. They're up against, they got a jury that's totally stacked and fixed and have a certain mindset and is destructive. And sometimes, of course, people surprise.
Apparently at the local level, if you don't understand the rules of procedure and you don't answer their complaint and information, then they actually just get you on a default judgment. And everything after that is just gravy for them. You know, they let you believe that you're in a court of justice, you know, like an Article 3 situation where justice actually...
Yeah, it's a facade.
The whole kangaroo star chambers situation. And, you know, like I said, I'm in a very unique position in which my significant other went through something, well, I can't say very similar, but is as devastating, where I believe that the term capital construction means manufactured crime, and I have proof of that. Because this is the one other thing I wanted to bring up, and this is a big subject, so whoever can just look and research it at their leisure, because it is a pretty big pill to swallow. But in Colorado, obviously, we have the Colorado revised statutes, and under Title 24 is government, local and state. And so that has all the provisions of what the state government and everybody in the state government is to do or not do and all, you know, just a ton of rigmarole. However, running simultaneously and in concert with statute for statute is something called the procurement code. And I'll just break it down into the most easiest way to, like, words I can use that everybody will understand. The procurement code. Now, procurement is a weird word, isn't it? And technically it means purchasing, but not really. And what the definition is, to obtain by improper means. Because I guess they have to tell you what they're doing, right?
That's
and
interesting. By improper means, huh?
Mm-hmm. And if you follow that word back as far as you can, not necessarily etymology, but when the word was first used. It's used in the Lex Mexicorum, which is the law merchant, which technically means a pimp. And I'm not trying to, I know this is a G or everything. It's, okay? And so...
Did you try to find it to see if it existed in Black's Law or Breviary or anything?
Yeah, this is all... That's where I got that from.
Got it from there. What is interesting about Black's Law is you can find the exact truth of what things are, and they do lay out the fiction of law, the difference between common law and civil law, and all of that is still in there. At least I don't go anything past the third. I got the second and the third.
Because I was on a fifth, but the best resource I have is a Webster's Collegiate 80, I have to look at it.
Well,
but
that should be pretty solid, huh?
It is amazing.
Yes. Webster was really big on really focusing in on this, and of course they destroyed Webster's Dictionary.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, like, it has every connotation that a word could, like it sprouts, like it blossoms like a flower. It's like in, you know, common usage, in old, you know, Germanic usage, in law. And you're like, oh, because you can see how the legalese plays into all of it as well, how that it just kind of flips a little shadow onto itself. It still kind of means what it, you think it means, but not necessarily really. And so all I want to say about the procurement code, so purchasing by or obtaining by improper means. So what that is you're just, it's technically how they buy and sell people.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard anyone talk about this before. I'm not out of my mind. I have researched
Well, it is clear they deal with us as chattel, and it's like livestock, yes, and that's exactly how they deal with us and the whole process and system set up in this nation to control us is in that fashion, and that's how they view us. People are sick. They really are sick.
Aggrieved party, right? You've heard of that
They
term.
Need to be put out of our misery. We do that through courts of justice.
I need that on a T-shirt.
Listen, we got to move on, but you're welcome, you know, because I got a couple more people, and we got to move on to something else. And in a little while, we'll go back into an open forum, and you can come back on again and talk some more.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Well, and also, if you'd like to expand more upon it, you have my number, so please call me back. I'd love to share a couple more insights that I have, and I wish everyone the best of everything and love and light, and God bless you all.
Well, you know, we do have a group that meets from time to time just to discuss things, so you should connect with that. Let me see. Terry, when does that group meet where you just have open discussion? Or Jan? If you're talking, I'm not hearing you. All right. Well, anyway, check into that. Get a hold of Jan. I'm sure he'll give you information. Maybe they're away from the computer now.
I appreciate all you do. Every ounce of it is very much appreciated.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it, too. Okay. Before I get going on to the night, I get two more callers. Gerard, are you here? I see you're in the room. Maybe in a little while I'll pass things over to you. Calling Gerard. Has anybody seen Brent yet? Brent, are you here?
I have not seen Brent. Gerard says he's here.
Okay. All right. Let me move on. I'm going to take these questions, and then you got probably some questions for me, and then we'll move into Brent or over to Gerard for a while. But let me take the next caller here. We got California Fred. How you doing, Fred? Did you get those boxes?
Hello, John. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Is the sound echoing through?
I'm sorry?
Is the speaker too loud?
It's not too loud. It's a little muffled, but you're okay. I can understand you.
Okay, sir. The only reason I put a question in was to follow up on last week.
Yes.
I did send you an email. I have not received the package and the labels for the two books. Yes.
Okay. Well, it could take up to 10 days, 7 to 10 days. Some people have been getting it in 3 or 4 days. But you're in California and I'm in New York. You're on the other side of the world, you know, so you're probably going to take the full 7 to 10 days. So it should come this week for you. But I did send them out, I think, the next day or the day after. I send them out quite quickly. You know, you'll get the stickers to put into the front cover of the book, you know, on the inside cover, which makes it the property of the sheriff's office. And then the two letters, you just slide inside the books, and you got them already addressed. All you got to do is put some tape on it and send them out. But put the book in first, you know.
I've been waiting. I didn't know. I wanted to take.
Yeah. Well, let us know next week if you get it. You should get it by then, for sure.
The lady you were just talking to was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
She brought out points that I never considered.
Yes, I know she has, and you know, I know I've spoke with her before. I recognize her voice and even her conversation and way of conversation. I know we've spoke before. Anyway,
it's going to trigger in me to look at the California Constitution and see if that word is in our Constitution, procurement.
Yeah. There's a lot of destruction in a lot of state constitutions, and it needs to be cleaned out. But before we can clean it out, we've got to clean out the feds. and put that back in proper and get the courts of justice back into the federal system. And then with our sheriffs and working with the committees of safety and building up the administrators for the jury and taking control of the committee man process and all those things, you know, that's how we're going to clean our state up. And, you know, anything that is repugnant to the Constitution or repugnant to our Bill of Rights, which is part of the Constitution, is null and void and needs to be dealt with within our constitutions. There are a lot of garbage in many of the state constitutions, and it does need to be cleaned up. But we have to get rid of this civil law first so that we can bring the people back to liberty again, free the people by having courts of record, which is a common law court that proceeds according to the true law of the land and the true law of the court, which is law written in the hearts of men.
I have a question that may or may not be relevant, sir.
Sure.
This stuff they're trying to push, like gun, you have to file permission to buy a gun or ammunition, and an FBI background check. That's why it's dead in the face of the Constitution. There's no qualifier for that.
Of course not. We're free to purchase and sell anything we want, and especially guns, weapons. You know, I can understand certain things, you know, certain people maybe that are banned from having weapons. And generally speaking, if a person goes to jail and comes out and serves their time and pays their debt to society, you know, they should have all their rights back. But in certain cases, maybe, you know, I could imagine the jury could make the decision as part of the punishment that this person could never have a weapon again. And of course, that's something that can be applied. Other than that, I don't know that they can apply anything. You know, we look to a lot of these older movies and things, you see, especially out west, when they release the people out of jail, they get the saddle. The horse is probably dead, but they get their saddle and they get their guns back, you know? but of course, you can't survive in the wilderness without a weapon. So, but nevertheless, it's an unalienable right that cannot be removed, can't be sold, taken away. But the people can do something, I think, you know, in certain cases.
Disturbed about all this is the open border policy with all these jihadis coming in, and then you got your little Muslim centers. They can bring their Quran to church or school, and they're not affected.
Well, that's all by design to destroy the nation.
And we got drugs and stuff pouring across the border. Now is more important time than ever to have a gun.
Absolutely, yeah. Look, all of that is by design and all to destroy our republic, our way of life. You know, even though Americans are ignorant to the truth of who they are as a people, they're ignorant to the Constitution, they're ignorant to the law of the land, they're ignorant to how common law is and, you know, the history of common law. And they're ignorant to the Bill of Rights. But one thing that has held us, I think, okay, is in the mindset of being free people and liberty, it's kind of in our mindset because we've inherited that mindset. And so we try to take a gun away from an individual. They don't even need to know about the Second Amendment. It's a resistance for that to take place. But that's the only thing that I really think has really been holding us together to some degree in the past, I don't know, 40 years or so, 50 years, probably at least. But if people want to have liberty and people want to get their nation back, they have to do away with their ignorance. And there's only one way, and that is to learn what these things are about. They're in the purpose of the book, Government by Consent. And we have to get our sheriffs, we really have to get them educated in this area so that they understand their true powers and authority, that their purpose, their only purpose, is to protect the sovereign, and we, the people, are the sovereign. So that's their job, is to protect us from an overreaching government. That's their main job. They're to enforce the law, and sometimes people break the law, and they got to do what they got to do. But nevertheless, their primary focus, their primary directive, their primary job is to protect the sovereign.
Okay, so, we can send them to the Rubber Gun Club. But I'll tell you this. What's got me going worse than anything else is the term terrorist, where there's really no definition, and the Congress right now is considering legislation that calls any veteran a terrorist. If you believe in the Constitution, you're a terrorist. If you're a Christian, you're a terrorist. I mean, what is this stuff in? They're the terrorists.
Well, again, this is all by design, controlling the narrative, controlling all of this in order to destroy the nation. Look, we're in deep trouble, and they're being exposed. And I think a lot of the people who are not aware of all of the conspiracies that they, call conspiracy theories are, they're becoming aware that there is a problem, and eventually they're going to see these conspiracy theories are no theories at all, but in facts, at least all the theories, all the conspiracies that I'm aware of, they're not. There's no theory here at all. There's plenty of facts and proof to show that it exists. And we've been laying a lot of it in the courts, especially all of the sins, so to speak, of the federal judiciary. You know, going right up to the United States Supreme Court, they're the responsible ones, because they could have corrected this, but they don't. They won't. And maybe because they got a gun to their head, so we can kind of appreciate that to some degree. And the enemy is in the court system anyway, you know. Half of the United States Supreme Court is the enemy of the people, enemy of justice, enemy of the Constitution, enemy of liberty. So, all right, let me move on to the next person. I appreciate it, Fred. And Bob, let us know next week about this, when you got the boxes.
I will, but where is the Cuore Warranto in progress? Are they doing anything with that yet?
Well, the very first paper we filed was a Cuore Warranto, and it's in the courts. Matter of fact, I'm getting ready to write another paper for that particular case right now. But if you, let me see, up on the page we were just looking at before, which again is under the grand jury coming down two steps down to action against the judiciary, you'll find the papers in there. But the Cuore Warranto was the very first paper we filed. That set the stage for the rest of all of the papers. And we have filed hundreds of papers into this court, more than hundreds, plural, okay? And we don't even have listed all of the papers that we filed up there in the sense, particularly of cases that have been moved into our case for court, to the federal courts for cause, and then in through us, and habeas corpuses, So we've hundreds of papers have gone in. Lots of memorandums. We have nailed a lot of papers to their doors, and they're going to have to answer to this at some point in time.
A quick legalese question, sir. Anybody going into a federal court, could we do a joinder and drag all that into our case?
We want to stay focused on dealing with subversion by enemies, both foreign and domestic, within the system, particularly focusing on the federal level, but taking it right down into the state, too. But right now, focusing, because we have to win on the federal level. Once we win on the federal level and the people take that court back, then all the rest of them is a piece of cake. It's just going to happen. There'll be no resistance that could withstand that. But we have to take the federal courts back. And that means taking down, in a sense, the United States Supreme Court. We have friends up at the United States Supreme Court, and I do believe at the time, when its time comes, that they're going to take the right stand. And the ones that don't, they've already exposed themselves as enemy. They'll fight tooth and nail till the very end because, there's plenty of evidence of their guilt. But once that happens, and the people are acknowledged again, we the people take back the control and become the lawmakers in which we are, no judge has an authority or right to make any decision in a court of law whatsoever, ever, period. They can only make their decisions in equity courts and not have an appellate process. Where courts of law, there is no appeal to the decision of a jury. And, of course, they stack them and they control them it's just a destructive process right now. But I see the day coming of justice. I do see it. But whether we can keep it up to the people to get educated to keep it. You know, we can get it back, and but people have to get involved. They have to get involved on their local level, in their counties, with county committees, and participate with that process there and support it in any way they can, even if they're just supporting it economically, you know, giving money to support it and at least occasionally attend the meetings and participate on the important times, you know. But anyway, so we have to teach our children to do this. Okay. Thanks a lot, Fred. We'll talk to you next week, all right?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know how many other... Oh, I'm going to take Kathy for right now. And again, I really don't want to get too involved in subject matters off of what we're talking about tonight at this point. I do want to get into other topics, but we've got a few other things we have to take care of first before we do that. But let me take Kathy, and then we'll see where we go from there. Kathy... you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Okay. Do you actually have access to that list of grand juries that I've seen? And is anything really happening with those grand juries?
There are no active common law grand juries save one. There's only the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. And
where is that at?
That's
where is
right.
That?
You're here at it right now. Whenever we write papers or we have a situation where we have to do a habeas corpus and the judge is failing to do their authority, you know, doing their job correctly, then we do end up indicting the judge. We call together a jury. We put the word out to our membership and anybody. They don't have to be a member of National Liberty Alliance to join us. Mm-hmm. And we'll set a date and time. We put the evidence up online for people to read. And consider, and then they come, and we make a decision. And most of our decisions have been almost unanimous. I mean, very, very rarely did we get anybody disagrees with indicting a judge that has failed to do the right thing, that has used their position to assault and destroy instead of doing the right thing and obeying the law. So when a habeas corpus goes forward and is put before a judge, and the judge refuses to deal with it, that's a crime. And they need to be indicted. So we've got over 100 indictments that we've laid before the courts, and we filed up in the Northern District Court, and of course we filed them up online here too, and we'll continue to do so. But we want to stay focused, you know, on certain things. We do stay focused on particularly non-judicial foreclosures, situations where we'll do habeas corpuses, where families are broken up by the family courts, and we also do habeas corpuses for any situation where anyone is incarcerated. We don't have the time or the ability to get involved with just any kind of a case, and we, you know, basically, you know, we're looking. For instance, let's take a non-judicial foreclosure, and all mortgage and tax foreclosures are non-judicial. They put the appearance of a judicial process, but it's not really happening. There is no judge's signature, and so nothing really goes through the court. It just appears as if it does. They'll have hearings. So those cases where people have lost their homes and they filed or they're in the process of losing their homes, we'll help them out by filing papers for them, educating the individuals, informing them of a crime taking place and their participation therein with it. And when they fail to do the right thing and stop participating in the crime, because we make it quite clear it is a crime, and then they have to step up and do the right thing. And if they don't, then we put an indictment forward. And again, it's set aside for later on because we're not going to get justice in courts of injustice. And it's going to take time for that. But at some point in time, the people have to be compensated for, especially those people who've lost their homes. The people have to be compensated for spending time in prison when they were hijacked and, you know, kidnapped into a process where they went to court. You know, every time a judge has made a decision in a criminal case, that's a crime because they don't have the power or the authority to do that. Only the people can fine or incarcerate. A person who is a bureaucrat like a judge, okay, has no business incarcerating people, nor do they have any business fining people. Now, that may be sounding strange to a lot of people because they've been brought up to think that, well, the judge makes the decision. They watch movies, they see TV, they're aware of court situations around them, and they think that that's how it works. Well, that's how it works in civil law. That's how it works for people who are enslaved by the government. We're a free people. We are under common law, and common law requires a trial by jury. Okay, so that's the king's bench. And the king, of course, of the court is the king of the universe. You know, it's God, and we are supposed to reflect His will. So when we, the people, make a decision, you know, that's a lawful decision, and it's unappealable. It cannot be appealed. When a judge makes a decision in an equity court, it cannot apply incarceration, nor can it apply a fine. Well, in certain cases, it may be able to if it's written clearly within their process. In an administrative process, maybe some kind of a situation like that. But, they don't have business in courts of law, only the people. There, no judge belongs in a court of law. But they've gotten rid of courts of law, so that's the problem. But the courts that they seem to be running, there are buildings, there are places where justice is supposed to be applied. They are the place where equity courts are to take place, and courts of justice, courts of law. And so we go to those buildings and we file our papers and we put them on file and we also file them up on online. And at some point in time, justice will prevail, but not until we get to the other side. And anybody that's listening to Dave on the X-22 report is familiar with the fact that it looks like we're in what Q has called Red October. And so if we are in Red October, I think that means we are very, very close. And Trump has said most recently in the past months that America is not going to make it to 2024's election, at least. It's not going to make it to 2024. Not 2024, 2022. America is not going to make it. So I think we're very close to that coming to the other side. A lot of news has been released recently on how much corruption was taking place in some of these counties and these states. And there's more to come. So,
what about decertifying, like Arizona, say, the Arizona election?
Well, look, it's all going to be decertified at some point in time because all he has to do is show one state. We've already done that, and the election goes to Trump. But there's quite a few of them that are going to be shown, and the desire, of course, is to take it through every state, and whether Trump won it or not. But look, at decertification has got to come. The certification that was done unlawfully, okay, ultimately, because there was corruption, clearly corruption, and they just didn't want to look at it, didn't want to hear it. So all of that is really null and void to begin with. But it'll be reversed. It's got to be reversed. And again, remember, getting to the other side and getting to that point ultimately means that arrests are taking place. You know, people think that Sessions, for instance, was the enemy and he didn't do his job. Nothing could be further from the truth. People think that Barr didn't do his job and that he betrayed the president and so on. Nothing could be further from the truth. And remember, Durham is still out there, and Durham now has been releasing some stuff. He's been dropping some carpet bombs, so to speak. And, there are indictments coming out, and they're getting very close to the indictment. These indictments are very close to the Clinton regime and many other things that are happening. So the pressure's on. Things are happening. Indictments are coming on the big wheels, the big ones. And I think a lot of the sealed indictments. Well, you remember, a lot of people have been removed from many corporations, and the CEOs, a lot of them have left themselves because they see the writing on the wall. Judgment Day is coming. It is very close. We can taste it. We can smell it. I know I can. And I can also see the fear.
What state did you say this grand jury, that the one grand jury that you do actually have convened, is
well,
in?
Well, you got to understand how we put this together. You know, we started this thing off and working through the states. We've visited every county in America. You know, some of the counties we did two or three or more together at the same time in a good location. But we went to each county in order to gain momentum, to gain and put together enough people to, you know, come together and bring a grand jury within within their counties and in their states. Mm-hmm. So what we did was the people of the state within many counties who came together and ultimately created the state grand jury. So, for instance, and we followed the idea of the unified system that's been set up here in New York and probably most states, where they unified all the courts. So we kind of followed that idea. We used that kind of an idea to unify the grand juries. So we organized a grand jury in every single state of the union. All 50 states have been organized in the sense of come together. We've got steels for all of these, and we also have the paperwork to put together to bring this out. We visited all the counties within these states, got the people to look at this and consider it and take a vote on it, and it's been pretty much unanimous on every county. You know, occasionally you get someone who would say no, but that is what it is. And but it wouldn't even have mattered, even if only one person out of 100 said yes, well, then one person wants it. We'd get it anyway because it's the right of the people to have this, you know, justice system that is under the common law. After all, we're a common law republic. So when we did that, we then came together, all of the states came together, and we filed all the paperwork. It is up online here. You can see all the paperwork. Where all of the states came together and agreed to unite under one unified United States common law grand jury. And the purpose of that is, first of all, we all need to become educated. We need to focus on the enemies, foreign and domestic. We need to really come to one point, and so that's what we did. And that's what brought us to the point of filing the paperwork here against the United States Supreme Court. Let me read this. It is an extraordinary action against the United States Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, U.S. House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive to our rights, it is the right of the people to alter government and institute new servants. That's the preamble of the Declaration of Independence. The people have an indubitable, unalienable, and indefeasible right to reform or change their government whenever it be found adverse or inadequate to the purpose of its institution, James Madison. And then we went on to say, this is that process. Since May 20, 2015, we the people served and filed the United States District Court for the Northern District of New York 160 documents upon the above said defendants for the specific recovery of the people's heritage stolen by the past judiciaries, congresses, and presidential administrations, sustained by the this present United States Supreme Court, Federal Judiciary, U.S. House of Representatives, and the U.S. Senate. The record shows that no respondents made any return and no respondents provided any objection. The natural liberty of man is to be free from any superior power on earth and not to be under the will of the legislative authority of man, but only to have the law of nature for his rule, Samuel Adams. This is that extraordinary action at law by the people under natural law for extraordinary remedy via writ mandamus demanding a return to the law. The people have been providentially provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of the judiciary. The common law grand jury on behalf of the people from December 2016 to present commanded via writ quo warranto informations, and that was one of the first papers, the writ quo warranto, which is a very powerful paper, but they ignored that like they ignore everything else. But it's going to get them. It's going to get them at some point. And writ mandamus is to all elected, appointed, and hired servants to obey the law of the land, to join the people in our quest to reinstate the Constitution for the United States of America and bring to justice also subverts who resist. We the people have been providentially entrusted via natural law dispersed to dispense justice and were provided legal recourse to address the criminal conduct of the judiciary and our representative. The people have the unbridled right by law and in law to impanel their own grand juries and present true bills of information, indictments, and presentments to a court of justice, which is then required to commence criminal proceedings under natural law. On August 12, 2019, the jury filed a declaration with an order to the decision, and you can read those decisions here, right here on this page. We are also joining hundreds of abusive court cases, whereas the jury will review and serve decisions and orders on behalf of the people. We're still taking on cases, and if you would like to join our case, you know, you can click here for more information, so on and so forth. So this is kind of an introduction or sort of a preamble kind of speech, so to speak, of leading into the paperwork that we have filed, starting off with the first one we filed on May 15, 2015, which was the writ quo warranto. And I believe we've read that way back when we filed it. Maybe we should read that again when Monday evening. It's a pretty powerful paper, the writ quo warranto. So anyway, so you right here is where the grand jury is. So you, if you wanted to join your case, you can get a hold of Jim.
Do you have a phone number for him?
Well, you send him an email and give him your phone number and information. He'll make contact with you and have some discussions as time goes on. But, you know, he's busy, so he'll call you when he can. But, you know, he can respond reasonably quick. Goodness, what is it called? Jim, are you here? What is your email again for the cases? I don't know why I can't think of it at the moment. Or Jan, maybe you may know or remember. I'll find out when I get off the mic, because I'm going to pass things off to, hopefully, to Gerard. Gerard's not here right now, but I do see Brent's here, so we're going to move to him in a short while, too. So I'll look to see if I can get it. And
one other question. The people that you have indicted,
mm-hmm.
That have been indicted.
I haven't indicted nobody. The grand jury has indicted.
That has been indicted through the grand jury,
mm-hmm.
that has formed.
Right.
Have any of them been arrested?
Well, no, because they got the guns. They control the narrative. They control the courts. They still continue under civil law. They're not interested in common law. They protect their own. So, no, they haven't been. And we didn't expect them to be. But we do expect them to be at some point in time indicted and to have to answer for these things. They were indicted in a proper fashion and process, and we have filed it with the proper places. We filed it with the federal justice system, you know, in the federal government. We filed it when Sessions was in power. We sent him, filed with him copies of our indictments, and when he left and Barr came into being, we filed it with him. And we filed it in the U.S. Supreme Court up in the Northern District of New York. And we also filed it up here on our website. So it's filed in many places, and it will have to be dealt with at some point in time. After all, we are the people. And they are committing crimes.
Yes, they absolutely are.
Yeah. Anybody who can tell you that they're getting solutions somewhere is not telling you the truth. There is success from time to time. We've had success from time to time. We've had success on a few habeas corpuses. We've had success against the United States, against the IRS. So we've had a few successes. Again, our cases mostly are sitting there nailed to the door of the United States Supreme Court and various other places. But particularly the blame, the big blame, considering the problems in our courts, rests at the door of, or the steps of, the United States Supreme Court. They're the responsible ones at this point in time. All these other courts are subservient to them, and they should make sure that they were applying the law of the land, and they are not. They should be making sure that common law is well and being practiced, and they are not. So, okay, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to move over. Brent, are you here? I see you're in the room. And Gerard, are you here?
Brent's here.
Okay, give me a minute then. Jen, we're going to have to forego the questions that may have been building up. I know we got a few questions that have been mailed in, but we're going to forego them for right now, and I don't know whether we'll get back to them tonight or we'll have to pick them up next week. Okay. Are there any announcements, Jan, that need to be made before we continue on?
No, not really, John.
Okay. How many questions are there, roughly, that we have laying around?
There's about three or four.
Do they look like they'd be short?
Some of them are.
All right, well, why don't we spend 5 minutes and, past 5 minutes we'll stop and we'll pick them up next week. Let's see if we can take them on. What do you got?
Well, the first is more of a comment. It says, I would like to see NLA make policy for those of us that know the difference, where a lawyer is recognized as constitutional and an attorney.
I'm sorry, can you say that again? You'd like to see NLA what? Read that again.
I would like to see NLA make policy for those that know the difference, where a lawyer is recognized as constitutional and an attorney recognized as a bar-affiliated person.
Well, that's an interesting statement or question or idea, because I have been taught, and shame on me because I never looked it up, that there is a difference between an attorney and a lawyer. And but I'll tell you what, this was brought up a week or two ago, and I even changed the paper to the word lawyer instead of an attorney, which is fine. I'll leave it that way anyway. I like the word lawyer anyway better. I do not see it. When I look into Black's Law and I look into Beauvier's, both of them are clearly make the point that an attorney and a lawyer are synonymous. They're the same. I do know that the elite, the New World Order, the minions of the New World Order particularly, which are the bar attorneys, that they, of course, try to change the meaning of words and things and phrases, and they give it different meaning. And, you know, for instance, if you come in and talk about being a citizen, it means something. But then yet, on the other hand, the U.S. Constitution uses the word citizens, I believe, seven times. Maybe even more than that, but I know at least seven times. So there's nothing wrong with the word citizen, but they've given it a different meaning, you know, as if it has something to be under civil law and be under their control or something. So it's a game they play with words, and they've done that. And we need to take them back. We need to take our words back. We need to put them back to where they belong, and just reveal the fraud concerning what they're trying to change. So you take the rules, for instance, the rules of the court. They should not be applied in a court of law. They shouldn't even be applied in a court of equity. They don't belong there, you know. So we need to take it back. We need to we empower them when we give them their way and we give them the meaning of a word. You can have the word citizen to mean something different, like they try to play games with. The 14th Amendment? Or I forget which one it is with the words, and the 13th, too, also. But, why are we going to give up? Let's take it back. Let's put it to where it belongs. We need these words, you know? So I don't see it. If I could be corrected on this, bring the correction on, bring me the necessary documentation to show me that there is a difference between an attorney and a lawyer. And again, I thought there was, but when I went searching for it, I haven't been able to find it. I read about it. I read people saying it, but I haven't found any documentation. So anybody that can help in that, if I'm in error, let's correct that error. Even if it's not this week, you can get next week on it. What else you got, Jan?
Do you have
maybe
this?
The person who wrote the question, maybe they have some evidence they can give to us, and we can consider it. But next question.
The next question is, do you have this book on your website? It's called The History of American Constitutional or Common Law with Commentary Concerning Equity and Merchant Law by Dale Pond, Howard Fisher, Richard Knudsen, North American Freedom Council.
Yeah, no, I don't have that book up online, nor am I familiar with it enough to be able to say I would put it up there. So I have to get a hold of it, look at it, and consider it. Maybe others have looked at it and could comment on it, but no, don't have it. Sorry.
Okay.
Next.
Next question. If common law is the law of the land, How does maritime law or the law of the sea get tried when one is faced in a court of justice under the Constitution?
Well, remember, everything they're doing is a mixed bag. They're pulling things from all over the place, and they're making it up, too. I mean, look at, I'm in court right now in a situation in federal court, and I've had three hearings, and I voiced the opinion that these hearings are unlawful, that there's no reason for these hearings. You know, why are we here? Let's get to the court case. But nevertheless, I've asked the jurisdiction all three hearings, and the judge refuses to tell me the jurisdiction, and then I would advise the judge that, wait, you know, it's required in any court to have the jurisdiction on the paper. And the last hearing I had with a judge, I asked three times, you're going to tell me the jurisdiction, what jurisdiction we're in? They wouldn't tell me. Well, I can't defend myself. I don't know the jurisdiction. I got to know what's going on here, you know. I'd like to, you know, see what's going on and get the jurisdiction, because I know what I opened. I opened a court of record, and I'm the plaintiff. So I don't know why I'm here in this court. And now the very last thing that this judge, I said to the judge, and the answer was no, was, are you going to tell me what jurisdiction I am in? And she said no. And that was the end of the case. Pop. Now, I haven't heard anything for many months. I just got some papers on that court case. I haven't even opened them yet. But, you know, but that's where we're at. That's the kind of thing we're up against. And so, you know, the jurisdiction is the major problem. Before I finalize that question, refresh my memory on the question.
Jan. Okay. One last one, which is mainly a comment with a brief question. With the recent audit of the 2020 election...
No, but I mean, the question I just answered, can you read that one again?
The last one? Okay. If common law is the law of the land, how does maritime law or the law of the sea get tried when one is faced in a court of justice under the Constitution?
Right. Well, first of all, people should not be tried in a federal court, okay? And it would be under very certain circumstances they would be tried. Of course, they have pulled us into court using USC 18 and USC 28, and referring to the penal code as if it applies to we the people. Because remember, they believe, and they're true believers too at this point. You know, they've been indoctrinated in their schools, like most of us have been to some degree. And they really have been indoctrinated when they went into college and studied law under the bar teachings. And they're true believers of this whole process. They believe that civil law is the law. And it's a mixed bag of everything. They throw everything in there, you know, and then they make it up. And they nullify what they don't like when it's used against them. Literally, they just ignore it and nullify it and move on, and as if you didn't even bring it up. You can't get justice in these courts. I mean, occasionally maybe you'll find a judge, but that's extremely rare, especially if you're going up against the status quo. If you're going up against corporations, you're going up against the government agencies, oh boy, it's an uphill battle, and you're not going to win. In very rare cases would you win. You know, again, very, very rare. So we can only make the case and do the best we can and package it in such a way and be ready to reopen it at a later date when we get to the other side, meaning being that arrest takes place and justice is returned. And justice will never, ever, ever, ever return to our courts unless the people become educated in how they can consent to government and our sheriffs become empowered in the same. Until that happens, we are not going to get our courts back. For we have to know how to do it. We have to know what to do it. I mean, you know, we here at National Liberty Alliance, we'll spearhead the process. But the people need to get behind it, and the people need to get educated, and they need to get active in their committees of safety in their counties, and we need to organize in our counties. Because, you know, true power and government control is all on the grassroots level. It's all in your counties. Okay, last question.
Okay. With the recent audit of the 2020 presidential election in Maricopa County, Arizona, the media failed to report the facts about election fraud and or inconsistencies with election ballots. Some envelopes without signatures deleted files, duplicate ballots, and or around 300,000 ballot images, 284,000 roughly, were missing and or corrupt. It's also said Chinese ballots were received. According to Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, after reading Arizona's full forensic audit, reading the canvassing audit, listening to the Arizona Senate hearings, there is zero doubt left that the Arizona 3 November election must be decertified, and the Arizona electors for the presidency of the United States must be recalled and allocated to President Trump, with the calling for Joe Biden resignation under the 25th Amendment. Would they reinstate President Donald Trump as a winner, or have they prepared the presidency for Jared Kushner?
Well, I don't know how that came into play. But, look, there are two people who ran for president. One cheated and is not the president of the United States, although some people think he is, and he's trying to operate as he is, and he's being let loose to operate as he is. But at some point in time, justice has to prevail. And if it doesn't, then this nation's totally lost. I have a lot of faith in Trump. He's always held up anything he's ever said, even before he was a president. And he told us before he left office, and as he left office, and after he left office, the best is yet to come. And you know, we do believe that devolution is in play, and that the military has been engaged, and it probably engaged long before Trump became president. We know it goes all the way back into Kennedy's days. And as a matter of fact, if you watch the documentaries that Griffin got out, they go back into the 40s and the 50s, some of these information, even further back than that. It goes all the way back to Jekyll Island. And that goes into the turn of the century, into the 20th century. But if you look at those documentaries and see what was going on, the generals, particularly during World War II, and you know, even World War I, I'm not sure what exactly much about that, but World War II, there was a lot of information flowing from our government to the enemy, and it was being picked up and realized by lots of generals and different people in power, and they couldn't stop it. So the assault upon our liberties, the assault upon our republic, and has been taking place. Look, the Revolutionary War has never ended. It continues to this day. It has never ended. We did not win World War II. We may think we won World War II. We did not. They infiltrated our nation completely. They have taken over our government completely. We have been an oligarchy for quite some time. Okay, there may have been a couple of presidents that tried to break away from that without success, but I think Trump did. He is the only successful one. We see what they've done with Kennedy. He tried to pull away from that. He tried to warn the people that we were in trouble, and that the revolution is coming, and we're not going to be able to prevent it from coming. You know, maybe we can make a peaceful one, and I think it's going to be a peaceful revolution and an ending to this thing. But that's where we're at. We've come to the pinnacle. We've come to the end. We're at the, we stand at the precipice, and it's about to happen. And I do believe, and again, taking a biblical position on this, the Bible, from my understanding, is clear that judgment will come against the nations. And so the evil of this world will be judged in this world. So I think we're at that time period, and that's my personal strong opinion, though. Timing's coming, justice is coming, and the question is who's going to be president once? There's no way to get. Someone's got to be president, and we'd have to just hook on to the last president that was president, as the rest of this unfolds. But it'll be clear anyway. Just in the battleground states, it will be clear that who won the presidency, right there. But I do think it goes even deeper into the other states that are not battleground. We're going to find a lot of corruption there, too. So, anyway. Okay, I guess that's the last one.
Yes, that's all, John.
Okay, Gerard, are you here? Has anyone seen Gerard? He was here, but I don't see him anymore. desperately seeking Gerard. We'll keep an eye out for him. Maybe you can send him a note to see if he's going to pick up the mic. Let's move over to Brent. Brent, you got your mic on? And the people in the queue will pick back up with you after Brent finishes. And we'll be open to any conversation on any subject matter. Brent? And you may walk away from the
yes, computer. Here I am.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Here's Brent Allen Winters. He's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. He's a common lawyer, and his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you have the mic.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And this is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com. www.commonlawyer.com. And my comments are my own, may or may not reflect the opinions of the leadership of National Liberty Alliance, but they're kind enough to let me come on and say a few words, and we'll see how far we get. Let me read this question again. I like this question. If common law is law of the land, then how does admiralty law get into the Constitution or into the federal courts? I didn't hear the last part real clear, but that was the idea. If common law is the law of the land, how does admiralty law get into the mix, get into the federal courts, get into the Constitution? Well, that first phrase is misleading, and it demonstrates that is common law the law of the land? That demonstrates the misunderstanding of what our common law is. Let me read that phrase again. If common law is the law of the land, well, that's not true. That's like putting an equal sign between common law and law of the land. Common law equal law of the land. That's what I'm taking from that, and that's a common idea. And I'd say most lawyers would say that and believe it. In fact, probably all of them. Maybe there's an exception. Judges or lawyers, they'd say that, and most people would say that. They assume that the law of the land, they assume that they understand the law of the land to mean the Constitution is the supreme law of this land. And that's not what it means at all, not even a little bit. And the reason we don't understand that properly in America is because the people that are responsible for teaching us truth have not. Who in our culture is responsible for teaching us ultimate truth? Well, what is ultimate truth? It's law. True law is ultimate truth. Because that's the way things are, and they ain't going to change. That's what law is. It's the way things are, and it ain't going to change. You're not going to change it. You can't break it. You can't break the law. If it's the law, you can break yourself on it, but you'll never break it. If it's true law, and true law is from the only true lawgiver, the final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances, from whose decision there is no appeal. Who's that? Well, that's the maker of all things. But let's back up to this phrase. Common law equal the law of the land is another way to say it. When you see the word is in a phrase, you could substitute the word, or the word, the algebraic sign equal in many cases, context permitting. That's what you can do here. Common law is the law of the land. That's the statement here. And the word if here, well, it means given that. So we could say, given that common law is the law of the land, then how does admiralty law get into the Constitution and into the federal courts? But the common law, the words common law do not equal law of the land. Okay, well, what is it? What is our common law? What is the law of the land? If you want to know what words mean, the best thing to do is to check out their etymology. Etymology. That sounds like something from the study of insects or something. Insectology. But no, etymology, it's a fancy word. It's a Greek word. It means to study the straight shooting. To learn about the line from which a word has come. Where did we get these words? This word law, land, supreme, all those words. Any words? Well, there's more, said Trench. There's more in the history of the etymology of a word. More often, there's more in the history of the etymology of a word than there is in the history of a military campaign. And William Barclay and Trench, a couple of men, spent their lives studying words. Well, I said a while ago, who's responsible for teaching this ultimate truth of what the law is? There are two classes of people in our country responsible, have been responsible, and will always be responsible, and will answer. And will answer if they haven't done their best. Who are they? Well, the leaders of institutions called Christian churches, whatever ilk they may be, and those that serve in our courts, lawyers and judges. The Bible says that the judges, one of their foremost responsibilities is to teach the law. Every magistrate, every elected official, his responsibility is to teach the law. That doesn't mean he holds lectures. A sheriff, I was talking to Sheriff Darr, our sheriff's class, and he said, it's my responsibility to teach people the law. Well, how do you do that, Sheriff Darr? He said, well, stopped a lady that was going around a school bus, and I instructed her, don't do that. That's not what the law demands of you. You can't drive around a school bus when the stop sign is out on the side of the bus. And he said, just to add the impression of it, if you do it again, I will arrest you and put your body in jail. Well, that helps drive the point home, you see. And he sees his job not just to be arresting people and be a professional thumper. No, but he sees his job to be an educator. Well, when you educate children, you tell them what to do, but it doesn't register always until you apply the Board of Education to the seat of knowledge. A consequence that is unpleasant, even painful, stings quite a bit. If it's done properly, of course it isn't always done properly, but if it is done properly, then that drives the point home. Yeah. Well, that's what the job of a judge is, the job of a leader of a Christian institution such as a church. Call him what you want. Call him an elder, call him a deacon, call him a preacher, call him a parson, call him a whatever. His responsibility is foremost to teach the will of the sovereign. The will of the sovereign. Who is the sovereign in a Christian world? It is the maker of all things, the creator himself. He is the sovereign, and his will is law. And the will of all any sovereign, whoever people take to be their sovereign, that will is law. That's why we call it law, and it will not change if it's true law. Well, talking about men of the cloth. There's another term we could use, men of the cloth. So they always, why is it in Christianity, in some sects of Christianity, the people that do the most work wear the most clothes? Looks to be hot and miserable to me. But they do. Well, those are the folk. Well, Ryle said, what do you expect out of people in a Christian country? He lived in England. What do you expect out of people in a Christian country that are, what do you expect out of them when they're anemic? And why are they anemic, he said? They're weak. They're ineffectual. He said, well, because the people that are responsible to be feeding them are not feeding them nutritious food, but they're feeding them rats and mice. Rats and mice. Their own ideas, what they read in a philosophy book someplace, instead of teaching them what God said, teaching them the Bible. Then they'll be strong. That's what God said, they'll be strong. Well, the question, though, being, the common law isn't, well, the question is, if the common law is the law of the land, the common law is not the law of the land. Let's try to say it this way. The phrase law of the land is an old phrase taken from Magna Carta, written in Latin, Stephen Langton wrote it in Latin. It's the phrase lex terra, lex law, terra, land. Land law. Well, that phrase, lex terra in the Latin, law of the land in English, means due process. That's what it means. When the Constitution of the United States says, now watch this, I'll try to nail it down here. Been talking a lot. Get to the point, Brent. When the Constitution of the United States says this Constitution is the supreme law of the land, what it's saying is this Constitution is the comparatively supreme way we do things in this general government, this federal government. This is how we do things. How? Not what we do, but how we do it. It's due process. It is the courses we follow. What are we fighting about with this presidential election? What are we fighting about down there in Arizona with this audit? Are they fighting about who's supposed to be president? No. That's the result. They're talking about the process. They're auditing whether the process was followed properly. That's our common law. What is our common law? It is due process. An old phrase for it is law of the land. Law of the land. Boy, it's funny. It's curious how words are twisted, not intentionally. If the common law is the law of the land, I'm so glad you brought this up, and I'm forever grateful you did, and stated intelligently, and given the premise, that's the general statement here in the beginning, if, that means if, it's not, it is, but he's just saying if. Well, given that, for our purposes of argument, if the common law is the law of the land, then how does admiralty law get into the mix of our Constitution? Well, here's the way it works. Does the Constitution say the common law is the law of the land? No. Is common law the law of the land? Yes. The Constitution of the United States and our due process is the supreme way we do things. That is all true. Now, if you've said, Brent, you're chasing your tail here, and it sounds to me like you're going in circles, and you go back and listen to this recording again, and you're still convinced about it, correct me. I'll stand corrected. Because I've talked so much now, certainly at some point I've made a mistake and said things backwards. I usually do. But just know this. An old phrase for due process, an ancient phrase, is law of the land, taken from lex terra. Our Supreme Court of the United States has recognized that that old phrase means due process. The course of our common law. Our common law is due process. So our common law is not result-oriented. It is process-oriented. That's what they're doing in Arizona. They're concentrating on auditing the process. They're not down there fighting about who's supposed to be president. And rightly so, and I like that. That's what God said for us to do. It's not within our jurisdiction to declare the end result. That's his business. He says so. In this day of man, as he's delegated government to us, before the coming of Jesus Christ, when all government will be put into his hands, all three branches gathered into a single will, Isaiah 33. Yeah. But in here, down here on land, right now, it's our responsibility to ensure that the process is followed, just like they're doing in Arizona. That's what they're doing. I go into court. A judge will say something to me, well, Mr. Winters, what am I supposed to do? And I say, always say the same thing, because the judge gets frustrated that way. I say, well, Judge, you and I both know that I'm not paid $175,000 a year to make that decision. You are, not me. Yeah. So all I can do is scream about the process. Hey, wait a minute, this ain't fair. The way you're doing things ain't fair. Well, you didn't observe this man's right to be heard. He hadn't been heard yet. You got the cart before the horse, Judge. That kind of thing. This ain't a fair fight. We come into court looking for a fair fight. You're giving the advantage to them by not giving us fair play over on this side, on our side. Well, okay, so common law. Many phrases and words have described our common law and been used as labels for our common law. Common law is a recent phrase. Before that, what we call our common law, before that, most recently, it was called law of the land. And And then before that, it was called the Laws of Edward the Confessor. He was the last Anglo-Saxon king of England. And then before that, it was called the Laws of Alfred, King Alfred. That was about, in the 800s. Then before that, it was called the Munaltine Laws. I hope I pronounced that right. It had different labels. Then recently, in recent centuries, it was called the Common Law. Why is it called the Common Law? People say, oh, because it's common to all men. Well, that's a little bit true, but not much. Here's what happened, really. A page of history is worth a volume of logic. Volumes of logic. No, just a page. We can talk about a page of history. Why is it called the Common Law? Because the Roman priests, the Normans appointed Roman priests from France to judgeships in England when they conquered it. 1066, they declared the Common Law still in force. But they appointed Roman priests. Well, Roman priest is a lawyer of the law of the city. What is the law of the city? It comes in different forms, but it's all fundamentally the same. It's a martial kind of law. Admiralty law, bureaucratic law, administrative law, equity, and international law are all different forms of the law of the city, the Code of Justinian. Canon law is one of the big ones. The canon law of the Church of Rome and of the Eastern Church, every priest in the Roman Church is a lawyer, foremost a lawyer, and studied many years. The canon law. You see, the canon law is the Bible of the Roman Church, not the Bible. The Bible's not the Bible of the Roman Church. The canon law is the Bible of the Roman Church. Oh, they give the Bible lip service, talk about it, and when it fits in with the canon law, they'll go along with it or try to make it look like it does. But that's not the final concern. The final concern is the canon law. The canon law is what governs the priesthood of Rome and a whole lot of other things. And because of that, we say the canon law. And it is the Code of Justinian put to an ecclesiastic purpose. Matter of fact, if you go to get a degree from university in the law of the city, in some places still, and it was this way all over the world, in South America they still do this, they call it the Doctor of the Canon and Civil Laws. That's the Code of Justinian. And they talk about both of them together because they're fundamentally the same thing. Well, admiralty law is the law of the sea. It's a martial law. Martial law is the law of soldiers on fields of battle. Admiralty law is the law of sailors and ships at sea. Now, those two kind of law are two abuses of the law of the city. Bureaucratic law, which is what seems to come to more intense use in where people are piled up like rats in cities, and they are. You see what happens in those situations. But to try to make order out of it, they are more martial law-minded. How did this all start? Well, it all started way back in Babylon, but in recent times, it started in 753 A.D., 753 B.C., 753 years before the birth of Jesus Christ, when two brothers that had been, according to legend, suckled by a she-wolf. In English, we call it a bitch-wolf. They're orphaned, abandoned something, and this she-wolf, according to legend, took them in and suckled them. You think, oh, that's crazy. That can never happen. Listen, I've seen little children suckle on hound dogs. You turn a little child loose and let a little child who can't speak yet but can walk or crawl watch pups suckle a hound dog, and the little child will get the idea and try to do it too. Yes, I've seen it happen. So that story doesn't seem far-fetched to me. Well, the little child doesn't know any better. If mom or dad turns their heads, that's what they'll try to do. Now, you see a child do that, you ought to stop them. It's not sanitary. But children do a lot of things that aren't sanitary. They have to be taught, of course. But it's only natural. Anyway, this she-wolf suckled these two boys, what was their name? Remus and somebody will remember. One of them was Remus, wasn't it? I remember that. Well, one of them killed the other after they tried to found the city of Rome. They were found in the city of Rome on top for the ruins of the city of Saturnia. the city of Saturnia had been devoted before to the worship of the heavenly body called Saturn, worshiping creation instead of the creator, of course. Well, Romulus, wasn't it? Romulus and Remus, that was it. They founded the city. And there were about 300 families that had gathered around those hills there that now called the Seven Hills of Rome, and the ruins of this whole city, and they, of course, had to protect themselves, and they formed a militia, what we would call a militia, and every able-bodied man, 300 families plus the servants, and the cattle and the sheep, they were pastoral people, agricultural people. So their law was, the law they applied was the law of their militia, which came from Babylon. It's the law of the city. And there is admiralty law in the Constitution, of course. Yes. As a matter of fact, the Constitution says that the federal courts have admiralty jurisdiction. That means jurisdiction over the law, matters pertaining to the law of the sea. And so when you talk about seeing the flag in the court with the fringe on it, that's an admiralty flag. Well, yeah, that's constitutional. The Constitution gives the federal courts admiralty jurisdiction. And when an admiralty case comes before the federal courts, they take jurisdiction over it. Then they apply the law of the sea, not the law of the land, our common law. That's a different kind of law. And the law, and admiralty law is the law of the city. Remember the law of the city, the Code of Justinian, the canon, civil laws of Rome, govern every country in the world, except that handful of common law countries and Islamic countries. They don't take and use the code, but they follow the same principles of the code. What is it? It's tyranny. People say, well, there's no tyranny in Sweden. They follow the code. There's no tyranny in Germany. Well, anytime they want there to be tyranny in Germany, there will be. That's what happened in World War II. And they decided it was time to invoke that power that the law gave the chancellor to gather all three branches of government into a single set of hands, legislative, executive, and judicial. And Hitler had all power, and the oath that the German soldier took wasn't to any set of laws, it was to him. Because there was no appeal from the decisions of Adolf Hitler. Same thing was true of Mussolini in Italia, in Italy. And no appeal. And the same thing was true in Japan. The emperor, he is God. I talked to a Japanese fellow the other day. He was trying to promote some weird religion to me, some weird form of Christianity where he said he had a present-day prophet and he was promoting him. And nice fella. I had to flat tell him. It was kind of, I didn't want to. He was my elder by a lot of years. But I tried to use that example with him. I said, well, you fellas used to worship the emperor of Japan, and you fellows used to say that he was 142 generations from descended from the heavenly body called the sun, and you had the genealogical records you claim to prove it. I said, is that right? Is that really true? He said, yeah, it's true. That is true. I remember all that. He was a little boy then. All false religions the same. You take something that's created instead of the creator, and you say it's the final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal. Whether it be Adolf Hitler, in a Christian world, they didn't call him God, but that's the way they treated him. They couldn't get away with saying it God because they had too many Lutherans and Roman Catholics. Of course, the Roman Catholic, again, we mentioned, he says that the Pope has all the power and authority of Jesus Christ down here on land. That's pushing the envelope farther than I want to go. That's too much. Well, that's how admiralty law figures in the Constitution. You see, in a common law country like ours, or England, or New Zealand, or Australia, or Canada, we must give place to the law of the sea. And we must give place to the martial law. And both of those, either one of those, put to their proper use, is right. And it's up to our common law to say, this is how armies are to be governed. And this is when they're on the fields of battle. And this is how sailors and ships are to be governed when they're at sea. I was a sailor once, a long time ago in another life. Just talked to my buddy tonight. He called me. Something great happened in his family, and he just wanted to let me know. And birth of a baby, and I talked to him quite a while. And we got to talking about the law of the sea. And when we were under that law, if you violated some part of it, I don't remember all the details of what it was, but you could real easily get 3 days on bread and water. It's a rough law. 3 days on bread and water. There is no jury. There is no right to remain silent. There is no, not even opportunity to be heard. There is no due process. It's just the old man, the captain, saying, well, he said you did this, and therefore I'm going to put you on bread and water for 3 days. Maybe that will wake you up. If he liked you a lot, or he didn't think he wanted to mitigate that a little, he'd say, I'll put you on bread and water starting next Saturday. Well, if he does it on Saturday, the law of the sea, back when we had Christian sensibilities, I don't know if they do this anymore, but on Sunday you get three square meals because it was against the law to have a man on bread and water on Sundays. So it'd be bread and water only, all the bread you could eat. They'd throw you as many loaves as you want. I get old after a while drinking that water. I always figured if it was wet, I could get by with it. But I'd rather have 3 days on bread and water than 30 days in the Marine Corps brig. And that'd be the other option. And sometimes a fella got that. That was bad. You know, if you're on bread and water, they'd even send a doctor in every day to check on you and make sure you're okay. Or the Marines wouldn't come in and try to beat you up, hang you from the overhead and torment you. Now, they do those kind of things. Some of you fellows listen were Marines, and you maybe remember that, but that's the law of the sea. When the Marines did those kind of things, that was the law of the sea. It's rough. Yeah, no due process there. And same thing with martial law. We could, the shorthand word for it with armies on fields of battle is drumhead court. That means they flip a drum upside down and put the indictment papers out there on it, and the commanding officer says, well, I think what we do in this case is tie you to a tree and shoot you. Why? Well, that's what the code calls for. No jury, no right to cross-examination, all that stuff. No, that doesn't. Well, that's the law of the sea, and in a common law country, there must be military, there must be armed forces at some point. Otherwise, you won't have a country very long, and that means the law of the sea and the martial law must have its place, even in the Bible. In the Bible, which is another expression, a written expression of the law of the land, martial law is given its place. The book of Numbers, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, that book is about martial law. It's about the law of the militia, the 12 several tribes of Israel. And it's about the law of the Levitical priesthood. You use the law of the city where obedience to orders must be quick or people die. That's where it applies. And that's why the Bible applies it to the militia of the 12 tribes, militia of the 12 tribes of Israel, and the priesthood. Remember, the priesthood had that kind of a problem. I mean, if a priest walked into the Holy of Holies, didn't do things just right. Well, let me put it this way. When he walked in there, he did it once a year. Only once a year, there was one man allowed to go into the Holy of Holies where the Ark of the Covenant sat. And that was the high priest of the Levitical priesthood. When he did that, they put two things on his body. They hung a bell someplace on his garment, tinkling bell, just it would tinkle, and they tied a rope to his foot. So he's in there, he walks in, they hear the bell tinkling, they can't see him. And as long as that bell was tinkling, then everything was okay. But if he made a mistake and God struck him dead for doing something that wasn't the proper process, then they knew they only had one option. Either go in and get him or drag him out with a rope. Now, who wants to go in and get him? I wouldn't want to do that. So they had that rope tied to his foot and they just drag him out, see? Now, that's not in the Bible anywhere. But they say that as a matter of history, that's the way they ended up doing things, because they had to find a way to deal with a problem like that. They wouldn't want to leave his corpse in there. Nothing in the Bible said they couldn't drag it out. Well, that's why we have admiralty law. That's why we have admiralty law jurisdiction in the federal courts. The federal judge takes off his common law hat, and he puts on his admiralty law hat. Well, it's an admiralty case. You guys are suing. You guys are suing the shipping company over a bottomry problem. That's a nautical term. Or this man here is accused of treason, of inciting mutiny. And so, well, you've seen this. Go get the movie, Caine Mutiny. C-A-I-N, Mutiny. It's about an American tin can ship, a naval ship in World War II. True story. Humphrey Bogart plays the part. Great movie. You need to watch it. Humphrey Bogart plays the part of the commanding officer that lost his mind. An executive officer of the ship finally took over the ship and said he was the commander. And then when it was all over, he was tried in a court-martial and under admiralty law. He was tried for mutiny. Fascinating story. And the man that the story was there. Well, let me get to the next question. Oh. What jurisdiction? Oh, John said that he asked the judge, what jurisdiction are we in, Judge? And the judge said, I ain't telling you. And John said, are you going to tell me or not later? No, I'm not telling you. Now, when I heard that story, I thought to myself, it doesn't seem like any big thing that a judge could just say, well, this is a law jurisdiction, or that we're in equity. This is a temporary restraining order. This is equity. But I'll bet the reason that judge, the justification that judge used to not say what the jurisdiction was, because a judge will say, well, I'm not allowed to give legal advice to anybody. I'm just up here to make decisions when you fellas fight it out down there. I don't want to. I shouldn't tell you. It's not right that I tell you what jurisdiction you're in. You got to figure that out yourself. There is a standing rule if you ever go to court, and with exceptions, and people without lawyers would have a little more leeway, ought to. And never ask the judge a question. A lawyer never asks the judge a question. It's an unwritten law. It's part of our custom. It's part of our common law tradition. But there's nothing wrong with asking. Well, I've asked the judge, does your secretary have a telephone number that I can, if I need to call? Things like that. But I'm just guessing, John, and I don't know, but of course the judge didn't say, but that's what, when a bureaucrat like a clerk in a court or a judge doesn't want to answer a question, that's the excuse they'll use. But it wouldn't have hurt to answer it. Nobody's going to appeal the case if the judge answers that question. And I think that the courts have a duty to instruct. And if they know the answer, they can instruct people. This is an admiralty court. We're in an admiralty case here. Do you not understand that? Well, the judge could say that. The judge can say, well, this is equity, and in equity, here's what we do. The judges ought to be doing that more often, but they'll use that excuse, well, I don't practice law here. All they're doing when they do that is they're just telling you, they don't want to tell you because they want to get you out of their court and get you out of their hair. That's the final thing. Well, I was going to talk a little bit about, here I'll get to what I want to talk about. Well, I want to talk about all this, actually, but to get more to the point, what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to mention getting a lot of calls about people losing their job because they won't take the jab. They're getting threatened. You're going to lose your job if you don't take the jab. And they're asking me, what can I do? And I've said from the beginning, and Gerard and I have discussed this, and I'm not sure he's in complete agreement, but I'll just say it. And if he wants to come on later or next week, I think we had a disagreement about this, but anyway, well, he of course can say what he wants, but I've said from the beginning that forget all the science, as important as that is. I mean, it just comes down to this. I'm not going to let somebody just stick a needle in me and inject things into me that I don't know what it is. That's a simple question. Do I have to know all the science behind it? Well, it's nice to know it, and I'm glad there's some people that do, and George studies that stuff quite a bit, and he's pretty informed about it. There are others, and I like that. It helps me. But bottom line, I just said in the beginning, I'm not going to do it because I don't want somebody sticking something in my body that I don't trust. I don't trust Bill Gates. He's the one that says to do it. I don't trust Joe Biden. He's the one that says to do it. No way. No way. Without trouble, there's going to be a fight of some kind if it comes down to that. Well, this is coming down to this with people losing their jobs, etc. I'm saying the First Amendment's a good place to hang your hat. The First Amendment. In other words, you have a sincerely held religious belief, and you don't believe that people should should have to submit to something that is your sincerely held, I say, belief. That's not strong enough. It has to be a conviction. Now, one fella sent me a piece of paper that his employer demanded he sign. He worked for a casino. I'm not promoting casinos. I'm just saying he worked for one. They said either sign this or we're going to fire you. Or take the jab or we're going to fire you. And if you have a religious conviction, you got to sign this here and sign it under penalties of perjury. Penalties of perjury? Why? Can I just let my yes be yes and my no be no? Why do I have to swear to it? You're forcing me to take an oath. Well, that's pretty touchy right there. Is it possible to force somebody to swear to something they don't want to swear to? That's crazy. Well, a lot of things crazy these days, isn't there? Like, that's unusual. Well, the First Amendment's important, but in order to have protection of the First Amendment, the law says that the practice that you want Constitution to protect has to be a conviction. It can't be a preference. It has to be a conviction. It can't be a preference. What's a conviction? Well, the court has defined that for us. The Supreme Court of the United States, Wisconsin versus Yoder. If I mentioned this before, please be patient. I'll mention it again. Doesn't hurt to hear it twice. In that case, the court said that the First Amendment does not protect religious preferences, even if they're very, very strong. It protects only religious convictions. That means, again, we'll go back to this principle, a conviction is something that not only doesn't change, it can't change. It cannot change. Tell one story and I'll quit. We rescued a rooster from the creek down below our house when I was a young fella. When the creek would get out, that means when it's flood, we'd go down to Iron Bridge and watch the water run by. And well, on our side of the creek, and we lived on top of the hill, at the bottom, it gets pretty wide, about half mile wide when it get out, across the bottoms. But the main channel was right there where we went down to the bridge. And there was looked over to the east, and there was a rooster, a young rooster, not a grown one, a very young one. Wasn't full size, sitting on a limb, and that water was swirling and sucking into that limb. It was a maple tree, real soft, a soft maple. And every time it sucked into that limb down the water, that rooster would go on. And then it'd come back up. And so that limb was just sawing up and down like this, you know, drowning that rooster. Now, in around rivers back in my part of the world, which is the Mississippi and the Ohio and the Wabash Valley, limbs that are sucked down in water and go up and down, and logs that go up and down like that in water that's moving, they're called sawyers. Sawyers. S-A-W-Y-E-R. Why do they call them a sawyer? Because it resembles an old sawmill going up and down. Some old sawmills went up and down, and the saw blade was set perpendicular, and it'd go up and down, and the log would move toward it, and it just went up and down and sawed back and forth. And that's how they sawed lumber before they used the circular saws, those big saw blades. So they called them sawyers. Well, a sawyer resembled a sawmill. Now, a sawyer also is a man that runs a sawmill. And they call him a sawyer because he causes the saw to cut to his liking. Somebody comes in and orders, they bring you a log, and they say, I'd like to have 2 4x4s cut out of this log. He could set the teeth on that saw, and he could set the carriage, and he could run that saw so it would cut two long timbers, 4 inches by 4 inches. That's why we call him a sawyer, because he'd make the saw cut the way he wanted it to cut. He could make the saw cut to the advantage of his client, the guy that brought the log. Well, now we also have a lawyer. A lawyer is a man that makes the law cut to the advantage of his client. He shows the court how the law, this principle of law, applies in this individual instance to the advantage of his client. That's his job. Just like a sawyer's job is to make the saw cut to the advantage of his client, a lawyer's job is to make the law cut, to show the court how it cuts to the advantage of his client. And that's right. That's not wrong. Well, the word lawyer stresses that aspect of an attorney. That's what the word lawyer. You know, a lawyer and attorney are synonyms, but they, like all synonyms, they stress different aspects of the same thing. In this case, two different aspects of the same profession. The word lawyer stresses his job to show the court how the law cuts in his client's favor. The word attorney stresses that he has been delegated authority from his client. These two words are synonyms about the same person. They stress two different things about him. Now, the word attorney is a Norman French word. Remember, the Normans conquered England in 1066. They lived on the coast of France. They had migrated from Norway 165 years earlier. And while they were there for 165 years, they picked up the French tongue. And they spoke a bastardized form of the French tongue that the French don't recognize as French, but nonetheless, they spoke it, and it was called Norman French or Law French, because in our common law tradition yet today, it is filled, shot through with Norman French words, and the word attorney is one of those words. The word attorney is a French word that means agent. It's a French word. Attorney is a French word that means delegate. It's a French word that means deputy. Any person that has received delegated authority from another to do a certain thing, the French called an attorney. I don't know if they still do or not. I don't speak French. They call him an attorney. You've heard of a power of attorney. That's a piece of paper somebody gives to you, and it says this person has authority to buy 40 acres of land for me, and he's authorized to pay X amount of dollars per acre. And this, in the top, it'll say power of attorney, limited power of attorney, because it's limited to that. Or you may get a power of attorney from your mother, your father, when they get older, and they'll sign it and say, my son or my daughter has, under this power of attorney, has authority over all my financial affairs and bank accounts. That happens a lot. I've made powers of attorney like that. Well, why is it called power of attorney? Because of the power of the agent of that person. Agent. What is an attorney? That's a French word that means agent. You got an FBI agent. Why do we call him an agent? Because supposedly he's been delegated authority to do certain things. We have an insurance agent. Why do we call him an insurance agent? Because the company for which he works, the broker, has delegated to him authority to do certain things. We have real estate agents, same idea. They have been delegated authority to handle real estate transactions. And then you got just the word attorney that has a license to practice before a court, and he's been delegated authority to speak for on behalf of another person before the court. So, is a lawyer and attorney two different things? No, it could be the same person. Every good attorney is a lawyer. And every good lawyer, not every good lawyer is an attorney. See, because the two, not every lawyer is an attorney. I like to say every man and every woman is a lawyer. You got to be, or you're not going to live long. Because you've got to accept the laws of nature, of the world around you. You don't go stepping out in front of Greyhound buses going 60 miles an hour. Because you understand the laws of nature of perpetual motion, and you're going to be splattered if you do that. Yeah. So you are a lawyer. And no matter what you're doing, I don't, you know, if you're a plumber, you're a mechanic, you're a farmer, you're a beekeeper. I met a fellow this weekend that has 3,500 beehives. Makes a good living. But in every one of those cases, those people study and learn and know a certain set of laws of nature, and they follow them so they can make a living. Farmer, same thing. Every man is a lawyer. But not every man has a license to speak for another man before the court. A power of attorney, that's what that is. A special one, a special power of attorney that has to do with people that are licensed to speak before the court by the licensing authority. It could be a bar association in some states like Florida and California. It's the Bar Association, Texas. In other states, it's the highest court of the state, the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois, licenses all lawyers in the state of Illinois. Two different ways it can happen. You don't have to belong to a bar, by the way, if you're in a state like Illinois to practice law. But if you're in a state where the Bar Association governs the practice of law, then if you're going to practice in that state, like Florida, you got to be a member of the bar. In states like Illinois, anybody can join the bar. I know people that join the bar of their state that don't have a license to practice law just because they want the benefits. You can get certain research tools and pay an annual fee. All they want is your money. Just give it to them. Just because you join the bar, though, there are many bar members. Many bar members that are lawyers, like all men. All men are lawyers, whether they understand it or not or whether they admit it or not. But not all men are licensed to exercise a limited power of attorney to speak for another before a court. This is Brent Allen Winters, CommonLawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. Join us for the Sheriff's Class Thursday mornings, 8 o'clock West Coast time, 11 o'clock East Coast time, and then you can fill in the middle, Rocky and Central. You can go to CommonLawyer.com and join us for that course. Sheriff Darleaf has agreed to help me teach that course. We're in the sixth week coming up Thursday. You can go back and watch all the others. If you join the class, it'll tell you how to sign up. You can watch all of them because they're all recorded. All recorded. You can listen to Dar and I talk about the office of sheriff. I return the microphone to Gerard.
Nope, I got it.
John.
Thank you.
Gerard?
I got it.
No, John. Okay.
This is John. Yep. Okay. Thanks, Brent. Appreciate that. We're going to go back to the open forum here and pick up questions. We've got a few people in the queue, so we'll get going. We only got about 15 minutes going, so we'll try to keep it short so we can get to everybody in the queue. Looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 people. Okay, Jim from Pennsylvania, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Yeah, John, it's Jim in Pennsylvania. I have questions and comments, and I'm going to tie it all together. I'm going to try to tie this together.
Okay.
I'm going to run for school board, and one of my planks is to teach the Pennsylvania Constitution. And one of the callers one time said they were never taught the state constitution. And, you know, who knew about the state constitution? But anyways, one of my planks is teach the Pennsylvania Constitution here in Pennsylvania and ciphering. Now, the ciphering, I was going to try to have some fun with this. But then when I went, and somebody tonight mentioned the Webster's 1828. Well, the Webster's 1828 put a different understanding on ciphering. So let me just read this real quick because there's questions involved. It says, in popular language, to use figures or to practice arithmetic and to write in occult characters. Now, I said, oh, wait a minute. What is all occult? And then I go to Webster's again and see occult, and it says, hidden from the eye or understanding, invisible, secret, unknown, undiscovered, undetected, as the occult characteristics of matter. And the occult science are magic and necromancy. So I'm not sure what that necromancy is, or what this other, whether occult, if there's another understanding of the word occult. But and then there's the other question. Let me just shoot this out. Occult line in the Webster 1828. It says occult lines. It's another definition. Occult lines in geometry are such as are drawn with the compasses or a pencil and are scarcely visible. So let me start the questions. Are you familiar with geometry where there's lines that are scarcely visible?
Well, I'm not, but I don't know, Brent, I don't know if you want to try to field those questions on this.
Well, I'll make a couple of comments real quick. Number one, necromancy. Necromancy is forbidden. The Bible forbids necromancy. That's a fancy word from another language that means communication with the dead. God utterly forbids communication with the dead. That is an occultic practice, somebody would say. It's the penalty in the Bible is death. And remember the witch of Endor. And King Saul went and tried to get the witch of Endor to call up the prophet Samuel so he could talk to him. And he had forbidden it and said he would kill anybody that tried that, necromancy. And necros means dead in Greek. It's a Greek word. It means dead, the dead man. So you don't want to do that. And Jesus Christ said clearly, that speaking of a man, you know, to be dead is not to go out of existence. And Jesus Christ uses illustrations to make that clear as crystal. And men cannot communicate with Abraham and Elijah and Moses and people like that. He said there's a great gulf fix. You can't go over there and he can't come over here. Can't do that. And so don't try it, because it's the most heinous kind of sin to get involved in that. Well, I got the impression you'd got a lot of definitions. Remember definitions, dictionaries? There wasn't a dictionary written in the English language until Sam Johnson back in the 1600s. That was the first dictionary of the English language. And men, even before that, there was no standardized spelling. Men spelled words, the educated men spelled words the way they sounded. I have letters from my great-grandfather. And he would spell the same word two different ways in the same line in a letter. And so dictionaries didn't catch on even until the last, not until the last, well, with the computers they really caught on. But they didn't govern. I know when I was in school they tried to teach us how to spell words right. But people in generations before me didn't really care as long as they communicated. So when you go back to look at Webster's dictionary, first thing you got to understand is Webster's 1828, for instance. Why did he write that dictionary? People always have a fundamental purpose behind what they do when they write a book or do any writing. Well, the reason he wrote that dictionary was because he said we need to have our own American language and let English have their English language, and we have American English, and I'm going to start the American English language, because he saw the power of the dictionary. He said, I'm going to start the American English language here in America, and I'm going to use the definitions of words out of the King James Bible. But that wasn't quite good enough for him, so he went ahead and translated the Bible himself out of from the original tongues. Well, he didn't really, it wasn't raw. He really reworked the King James. He reworked the King James, but then the context is what gives definitions to words. You're looking for definitions to words. All these people that write dictionaries do is, for example, Noah Webster, he went to the Bible, the King James Bible, and he said, "Okay, I'm going to trace this word through the Bible, and I'm going to see the common thread of meaning in every one of its uses. Even though it has different shades, the context will provide different shades of what is stressed in the word. Still, the word always has a fundamental meaning, and he tried to find that, and he took it out of the King James Bible. That's what the 1828 dictionary is. People say, well, that's what people thought the in 1828, that's what the word meant. No, that's not true. That is not true. That's what Noah Webster said that how the Bible used that word. That's what that was. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying, when you go to Webster's 1828, don't think you're getting the exact meaning of words that are in the Constitution, for instance. That's not always true. So don't rely on it for that. Rely on the 1828 dictionary to tell you how words are used in the King James Bible and what a powerful and a tool that is and what a great service he has done to us to enhance Bible study, but it's not used that way. It's kind of surprising to me, but I suppose people don't go back, and they ought to. I'll go back and look at why. For instance, if you want to know why the King James Bible is what it is, well, look at why King James wanted it translated. Then you'll know a lot of things about it. And you'll, if you know why what the reason behind the translation was, it'll open up a lot of understanding. A lot of understanding. Well, back to Webster, but you're talking about all these definitions. Just keep in mind that what people say a word means isn't what a word means. The way a word is used is what it means. Every word is context dependent. Let me give an example. Every word is context dependent, and it could be just almost the opposite. For instance, the word for holy in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word is kadosh. Kadosh. And in the ancient world, in the Semitic world, it was used two ways. It's translated holy in our Bible, and we think, well, that's a good thing. Well, what it really means is to be set aside for a specific purpose. To be set aside for a specific purpose. And when God sets a man aside for a specific purpose, that doesn't mean he's perfect. That means he's holy. That means he has been set aside for a specific purpose, and that's what a Christian man is. But then that word is also used in the Semitic tongues, and there are several of them, to speak of a temple prostitute. Why? Because a temple prostitute was set aside for a specific purpose, a very specific purpose, a religious purpose. But it was a very ugly and bad and abusive purpose. Men would come and pay to abuse women like that. That's what that is. That's abuse of women. They would pay it, and the temple priest would get a lot of money for it. They were the pimps, you know. That's the way that worked. But the word is context dependent. Whether you're talking, you can use the same Semitic word for a temple prostitute and also turn around and use it in a good sense because it fundamentally has the same meaning, but context will apply it in two different ways. So when you go to see what a word means, don't just depend on the dictionary necessarily unless you understand why a dictionary says what it says. But in all instances, in English dictionaries, the people that write those dictionaries, they trace the meaning or the use of words by context. John, did you disappear? There he is.
Okay. I think there was a lapse there. I don't know if it was me or you, but okay. Thank you, Brent. All right, Jim, now it's 3 minutes left. Do you have a final statement about that? Or?
Well, oh, no, that's okay. I'm good. Oh, him. Yeah, go ahead. Jim. Go ahead.
Jim.
Well, Brent, I would like that, like I said, back to that. I have two more quick thoughts about this Webster's 28. It says, and this is the part that I would really like to know about. It's occult lines in geometry. This is the word occult. Occult lines in geometry are such as are drawn with a compass or a pencil and are scarcely visible. What is that? What are they trying to tell us? They're scarcely visible. I'm not that...
Boy, that's fascinating, yeah. I don't know what he means by that. I'm thinking, well, he's talking about the occultic lines scarcely visible. That's a mystery to me. I'd have to go study it to know. I don't know.
Okay, I thought somebody that had studied geometry would know, mathematics would know that concept of scarcely mm-hmm. visible lines in geometry. But let me...
No, I took geometry. No, I should say this. Geometry took me in high school, and I don't remember any invisible lines that were barely visible. John, do you remember any of that?
Nope, not at all.
Okay, so the question, what does, if I use that in my one of my planks, what does ciphering come to mind? What do you think of when I refer to teach Pennsylvania Constitution here in Pennsylvania, and ciphering. That's the point I wanted to make. Okay, I said that Webster's 1828. Now I'm going to refer to the Webster's New World Dictionary, and that says that ciphering was archaic. And I understand that, but there is a difference between the Webster 1828 and the Webster's New World Dictionary. I wanted to make that.
Oh, very much. That's a whole. Oh yeah, very much. Webster's New World Dictionary, they don't care about the Bible. It has nothing to do with it. But the 1828 is his attempt to define words according to God's usages of those concepts in the Bible. That's the difference. On the dictionary, the modern dictionaries are just men that try to trace the usages of words, the popular usages of words among people. Popular usages. Unmoored from what God said. That's really true. Yeah. Go ahead. Back to you.
All right. Well, hopefully that will be sufficient for you, Jim. We got to move on.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's very, very helpful.
Okay. Thank you. All right, we're going to take at least one more caller. It's midnight, but we'll take Jim from New York, and we'll have to end it there. I know there's a few more people in the queue, and hopefully we'll get to them next week. But Jim from PA, you got a minute or two? Well, I guess I didn't. Let me unmute him. I don't know how that happened. So, Jim, you got the mic?
Okay, if it was me.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant Jim from New York. There's another Jim, but we just lost Jim from... Oh, no, Jim from New York. You're unmuted. All right, I'm going to mute you back, Jim, from PA. Jim from New York, you got the mic. Unless you're sleeping. Away from the computer. Okay, we'll take Ed. Ed, you got the mic. Ed, are you there? Ed? Last call for Ed. Okay, we'll take Felicia from Florida as our last caller then. Felicia?
Hey, how are you?
Good, how you
I got
doing?
All right, I have a quick question.
And I hope it's quick. It's a quick answer.
Yes, it pertains to the 3/5 clause. And I know yesterday was Columbus Day, but mm-hmm. I acquired a book called They Came Before Columbus about the African presence in ancient America. And it also refers to the Africans in Mexico, according to the Mayans. So if the Africans was already in America, how does the 3/5 clause in the Constitution apply to slaves? They were already here, because I know that blacks were considered Native Americans, then they were considered Negro, then they were considered blacks, then it was considered African Americans. So how does the 3/5 clause apply to them?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are two great sins of America that have really, really put us into a real bad situation. One of them, of course, is slavery, and the other one is abortion. Of course, there's many more, but those are two major sins that really, I think, has cursed America and caused problems. But from what I understand, and I've heard, is that the idea of 3/5 had to do with taxes and money that's going to be given to, you know, the federal government would dish back out, I guess, accordingly across the colonies back in those days, the states, the new states. So I don't know exactly how that worked, but I know that it was sort of a compromise, and it wasn't a compromise that was enjoyed by many, I'm sure. But I don't have any further knowledge than that. If Brent has some knowledge and he wants to pipe in real quick, he could. But I don't have too much on that.
I don't. Not sure I understand the question, but I do know that the Mayans and the Incas...
Well, the question really was focusing in on the 3/5 and the Constitution with the...
Oh, okay. That was a compromise that was arbitrary. And I get what you're saying. That was a compromise that was arbitrary. No, arbitrary, that means there was no standard to say, well, why would you say that if there's this many men that have darker skin than us, that they're worth three-fifths and they're not worth five-fifths? Of course, the reason was they didn't have a political status.
It makes to do with the census and the money dispersed. I believe it had a lot to do with the census and the money dispersed.
Yeah, and it did. It had,
and the argument.
I agree.
The argument from one position, I think, was the idea that eventually it would help to destroy the slavery position. And, of course, it eventually did end in Lincoln's day. But anyway, that's kind of what I understand about it. But I don't know.
No, I agree. It had to do with taxation. It had to do with taxation. It even says, speaking of the red man, it says Indians not taxed. So they did a lot of mathematics there to try to come to those conclusions. But it was the fly in the ointment that was bound to blow up sooner or later, and it did. It couldn't last. People say, I want to bring this up if I can, John. The people complain about America and how racist we are. It is the English-speaking world that did away with slavery for the first time in the history of humanity. A Christian English-speaking people did that. And for all of the sins of the Christian English-speaking people, doing away with slavery wasn't one of them. We're the only people. The English-speaking people are the only ones that have ever, in the history of humanity, ever done that. But yet, the whole world accuses us of being the guilty party. Well, of course, we're guilty, but who isn't? That's not the question. The question is, who got rid of it? And now people say that Wilberforce got rid of it. But by the way, being white and black doesn't have anything to do with it. It's being Christian that has everything to do with it. That makes a difference what color you are. And the Christian world did that. And Wilberforce did not get rid of slavery in England. It's popular. There was a movie came out not too long ago about Wilberforce. Wilberforce pushed to get rid of the slave trade in the British Empire, not slavery. As a matter of fact, slavery has never, ever, ever been lawful in the country of England. There were slaves there, but the common law never permitted it. There was serfdom, but there was never slavery. Why was there slavery then in the English colonies? The reason there was slavery in the English colonies was because it was the popular consensus of the government and the people of England that the common law did not apply in the American colonies. I'll say that again. The reason there was slavery in the American colonies, there was none in England. There were people that, we even had one fellow went there with his slave, went to England from Virginia. And when the slave hit the dirt, he absconded. That means he got rabbit in his blood and he disappeared. Because he said, my foot touches the dirt of England. The law of England is, I'm free, my chains fall off. His name was Somerset, I think. And there was a big habeas corpus case. They finally caught him. And then habeas corpus was filed for him and them because slavery was not lawful in England. But England said, in our empire, the common law does not apply. Our empire. You know, the king of England, King George III, was king of England, but he wasn't king in America. He called himself the emperor. Well, if it's the empire and the law of the city applies and admiralty law applies and not the common law, then slavery is legal. You see, slavery is legal according to the law of the city, if they want it to be, but not according to our common law, the law of the land. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Brent. All right, with that, we're going to end it, Felicia. I don't know if you want to make a final statement or something before we end it.
Well, it's just that somebody gave me a book that came before Columbus by Ivan Van Certina, and it has a Mexican omelet, the head of an African man on it. And it does the history and had ancient artifacts about how Africans were in America before Columbus, and yesterday was Columbus Day. So I was taking a government by consent course, and I was going through the founding fathers, how they built the Constitution on Christian principles. And I thought about that, so that's why I wanted to ask that question. So,
yeah, you know, I wrote a paper on this, and it's also in the book concerning slavery and our founding fathers. Maybe we'll read that section if it's not too long. Maybe we'll look at that next Monday. I'm not sure what we're going to discuss, but I'm going to consider looking at that next Monday. I don't know whether we may have already looked at this paper in the past.
Well, can you send it to me so I can read it?
Well, sure. You know, I'll tell you. Let me see. You'll have to give me your email. Why don't I do this? I see your phone number there. I'll give you a call tomorrow, and I'll get your email. All right? So
yes,
give
sir.
Me a second to write it down. Okay. Yeah, I'll get your email. I'll give you a call tomorrow, and I'll get your email, and I'll send you a copy. And,
yes, sir.
And it is in the book. There's a section in the book, Founding Fathers and Slavery. And you know, Lincoln, in that my study, my research on that, Lincoln had a lot to say concerning the Founding Fathers and slavery and the intentions of the Founding Father. And remember, Jefferson started the whole thing off, all men are created equal, you know, in the Declaration of Independence. That's the foundation of our law. That's the foundation of our rights, our honorable rights, all men. You know, not, you can't have some men equal and other men less equal or something, or however you want to put that language. It just doesn't work, you know. It is that which is just or that which is not just, you know. So, but yeah, I'll give you a call tomorrow sometime, okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Felicia. Okay, with that, we're going to end our call tonight. I appreciate everyone from coming, and Lord willing, we will be back Monday, and we'll pick up another topic next week and take it from there. Good night. Thank you.